I'd like to call the board, and you can't hear Will? Wills, you can hear. I'm sorry. Again, I want to call the meeting to order and particularly welcome the members of the board, but more specifically to welcome all of you that have an interest in participating in this important meeting today. I'm Dave Fredrickson. I serve as the chair of the EQB board, and I'd like to start over on the right-hand corner, my right, with Matt. To introduce yourself, please.
Commissioner Mossman, Commissioner of the State Department of Administration.
And before we go any further, we have two brand spanking new members. Well, one has been around for a while with the governor's office, but Tom, please introduce yourself, and if you would, just a little bit about your background.
All right. Thanks.
Speak right into the microphone so Willis can hear you.
And I was told to keep smiling. Okay. All right. Thank you. As you all heard, my name is Tom Moibi, new citizen board member here. So I'm really excited to be a part of the board and help, you know, the community. I like participating and volunteering in the community. So currently I work for Honeywell International as a Director of Environmental Health, Safety, and Facilities. I oversee their North America operations. I'm based here in Minneapolis. So education-wise, I've got a background in business administration, environmental health and safety, and law. So really, as I said again, I come into the board with a very open mind, just looking to learn and help make smart decisions that are going to ensure we protect our public health. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom, and we're really pleased to have you. Another Tom.
Yeah, you have to keep us Toms apart so people don't get confused. But so I'm Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources.
Mike Rothman, the Commissioner of Commerce.
Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead.
John Saxog, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Kate Knuth, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Charlie Zelli, Commissioner, Department of Transportation.
I'm Leah Hedman. I'm with the Attorney General's Office. I do not vote on the board. I advise them.
Will Seifert, Executive Director, Environmental Quality Board.
John Linkstein. I'm Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
And our second new member to the board.
Shantira Hardy, newly appointed Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
And we have worked at length on a variety of issues with Shantira, and we're really happy to see you in this new position there. The Department of Economic Development will be much better for your presence there.
Thank you.
Brian Napstead, Chair, Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Kristen Eide-Tollefson, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Paul Allwood. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm just sitting in for Commissioner Ellinger.
Thanks for being here also, Paul. With that, my chair's report is really not much. I will yield to the executive director for his report. My apologies for missing the last meeting. I was out of town, but my thanks to Brian for stepping in and managing what I'm told was a very well-run meeting.
So, always a pleasure, Mr. Chair.
The low bar.
that it is.
Had to be said.
Had to be said. Yeah, let's get it out. Anyone else? Yeah, okay. Yeah, my friends, right.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Board, a couple brief updates here. Staff update, we started interviews this morning for the vacant planner position. That's dedicated to environmental outreach and communication. We will keep you updated as we move through the process. A brief update on an intern. We brought on board Samantha Rodermacher. I think I pronounced that right. She's a University of Minnesota student studying environmental sciences, policy, and management.
Wave your hand back there, Samantha. There, okay, very good.
Thank you, Sam. She's our 2016 Environmental Review Program intern. And over the next couple of months, she'll be compiling a brief report on incorporating climate change discussion in environmental review documents, and we'll get her in front of the board to present in a couple of months. A couple updates about upcoming meetings to make you aware of. Our next board meeting is June 15. You'll hear a presentation on the Energy and Environment Report Card preparation, a presentation on social costs of carbon, and the environmental review surveys and data collection effort. We'll update you on as well. And then in place of our July board meeting, so the afternoon of July 20th, we're working with Environmental Initiative to host a public meeting on climate planning where we'll be presenting the CZO results. We'll plan to have some board commissioners serve as active participants on an agency leadership panel, so please let me know if you have a conflict with that afternoon. We'll be having a public meeting on June 28th to discuss proposed changes to the mandatory category rules. This came before the board back in February. Board members are welcome to attend, and we'll circulate details as they're finalized. And then we're also beginning our work on planning for the 2017 Environmental Congress, and just please put a hold on your calendars for Friday, February 3rd, 2017, and then stay tuned for additional details.
Thank you. Questions for Will? Seeing none, we will then move as quickly to item 5 on the agenda, which is the designation of a different responsible governmental unit for the environmental review of the North Dakota Pipeline Company, LLC's proposed Sandpiper Pipeline and Enbridge Energy Limited Partnership's proposed Line 3 replacement pipeline. I'd ask Courtney I suppose that'd be a good idea to adopt a consent agenda before we move. I always forget that.
So move, Mr. Chair.
There is a motion to adopt the agenda. There is a second. Is there further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Thank you for getting me back on track. Now for item 5. I'd ask Courtney to come up, and she has already planning director for environmental review at the EQB. Welcome, Courtney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and board members. And again, for the record, my name is Courtney Allers-Nelson, and I am the planning director for environment review here at the EQB. Today, I'd like to provide you with a brief presentation on the decision that is before you. And that is a request to designate a different responsible governmental unit. So more specifically, I'm going to address these four items, beginning with the request, the public comment, the draft documents, including the resolution and order that were included in your board packet, and finally, your decision. Beginning with the request, Mr. Chair and board members, in early March, the EQB received its first request for the board to designate a different responsible governmental unit for the environment review of the North Dakota Pipeline Company's proposed Sandpiper Pipeline and Enbridge Energy's proposed Line 3 replacement pipeline. Last month's meeting in April, I described those two projects, and that same project description and information was included in your board packets, so I will not be spending time talking about the projects today. Rather, I'd like to focus on the request before the board, as well as the documents that were prepared for your decision. As you know, subsequent requests followed that initial request in early March. All the requests, actually, had the removal of the existing responsible governmental unit, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. And yet all the requests had a different proposed RGU. One request asked for the joint designation of the Department of Natural Resources and the Pollution Control Agency to serve as one RGU. Another asked that it be DNR or the PCA as the new RGU. And a third request was for the EQB to be a potential RGU. I want to note that all those requests were considered together in your findings of fact and will be considered together as a request to change the RGU going forward. During that time, we also received a request for the EQB to hold public comment on the designation. We agreed, and we offered a 30-day public comment period starting on April 1st, and it concluded on May 2nd. We provided an opportunity for written comment. We set up an inbox and a web page. We also provided a listening session here by our board members at the last board meeting. Commenters could come and comment directly to you as board members at that April board meeting. Overall, we ask that the commenters focus their comments on the applicability of Minnesota Rules 4410-0500 as they provide direction for the EQB in the selection of an RGU. The comments we received during the comment period were wide-ranging. But before I get there, I skipped a page. More importantly, the commenters themselves were wide-ranging and coming from all walks of life. We had Minnesotans, whether they were from the north or the southern part of the state, commenting. We had tribal organizations and chairs and executive directors commenting. We had interest groups, those representing concerns for climate change or the industry, as well as many chambers of commerce and local units of government participating in our comment period. Just as wide-ranging, of course, were the public comments. And we had comments that are not fully inclusive here, but these are some predominant themes that we saw throughout the comment period, including concerns about public engagement, the involvement of tribes during the process thus far. We heard a request for environmental impact statements to be completed. We also heard information on regulatory capture. All of those comments were included in your board packet. And I want to acknowledge to all the commenters who put in a lot of work and effort to the comment period that we did not overlook their comments, and we did include them in the board packet. However, the board packet was so large, we broke them up, the board packet, into three parts. So many of the comments were in part two, should you be looking for any specific comment. So, while the comments were wide-ranging, our decision is much more narrow in scope. We asked that commenters provide information on Minnesota Rules 4410-0500, specifically subpart 5 and 6. It is those rule parts that we were looking to in order to develop the findings of fact and the conclusions of law and the order going forward. And I want to remind everyone, I'm sorry, I skipped a slide, but I want to remind everyone that the focus of the request is really on whether we need to designate a different responsible governmental unit. Despite all the information we heard and we received, our focus is much narrower. That brings me to the documents in front of you, including the resolution. The resolution, which is on page 1 of the prepared documents for this decision, is very simple. The resolution simply states that the EQB approve and adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and the order. So, with that, I would like to spend some time highlighting some findings of fact and conclusions that I find especially valuable to the board members. There are 86 findings and 7 conclusions of law. I am not going to go into each one of them here. Rather, I'd like to highlight a number of them. You've already heard about the request and the public comment period. All of those are covered as procedural history in the findings. So I'd like to begin with this simple fact that we know both proposed projects require environmental review, and that both projects fall into the pipeline mandatory EIS category. Consequently, the category identifies the commission as the responsible governmental unit. This finding led us to determine that Minnesota Rules 4410-0500, subpart 5, does not apply in this matter. And so we look to subpart 6 to determine whether the RGU should be changed. So, if you would like to read subpart 6 with me, you can go to page 9 in your packet. Subpart 6 essentially says that we must determine whether a different RGU has greater expertise than the Public Utilities Commission. In addition to an EIS being required for the routing of the pipelines, on September 5th, 2015, the Minnesota Court of Appeals issued an opinion and an order that the commission complete an EIS for the Certificate of Need for the Sandpiper Pipeline. Consequently, the commission has ordered that both pipelines have an EIS completed for the Certificate of Need and routing. Moving forward, the commission then asked the Department of Commerce to enter into an agreement with the Department of Natural Resources and the Pollution Control Agency for their assistance in the completion of these EISs. The MOU facilitates the interdisciplinary approach to the preparation of an EIS, which is the intent of Minnesota Rules 4410-2200. The EQB finds that the memorandum consolidates the expertise of several agencies. The PUC, as the RGU, has a long history in applying the criteria for the certificate of need determination and for pipeline routing. The Department of Commerce has experience in the preparation of environmental review documents for large energy projects. The DNR has expertise in natural resource management, including the issuance of licenses and permits for crossing state lands and water use. And the PCA has oversight for stormwater, tanks, and spills, just to name a few. Finally, in applying Minnesota Rules 4410-0500, Subpart 6, we must look to whether any other designee would have greater expertise. Consequently, with this MOU in place, staff find that no single governmental agency can provide greater expertise in analyzing the potential impacts from the project, and that with this interdisciplinary approach in place and with the commission as RGU, we see no need to change. That brings me to the order, the last page of your document. The order asks that EQB deny the request to designate a different responsible governmental unit for the environmental review of North Dakota Pipeline Company's proposed Sandpiper Pipeline and Enbridge Energy's proposed Line 3 replacement pipeline. And it orders that the commission, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, remain the responsible governmental unit for both projects. So, commissioners and board members, I'd like to talk to you about the decision that's in front of you, just to be clear. A vote in the affirmative this afternoon means that the commission would remain the RGU for the environmental review of the proposed projects. A vote against the resolutions, the findings, the conclusions, and the order would mean that no change would occur to the existing RGU until an alternative resolution could be prepared and approved by this board at the next board meeting. Mr. Chair and board members, this concludes my abbreviated presentation of the resolution, findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order that is in front of you. And I'm happy to take questions, should there be any.
Thank you very much, Courtney, for the explanation and also the end of the explanation or the end of the document where you give a clear direction as to the matter of voting. At this point, are there comments or questions that one might have regarding the presentation by Courtney?
Mr. Chair?
John?
In our meeting last month, and also in our information that we've received, I've I've felt there's a great amount of distrust in the process that's gone on so far, some troubling observations. And so as a citizen member, we're all sensitive to it, but I think I'm especially sensitive to what we have heard from the public. And I guess just in way of clarifying how I feel about the order in front of us, I wanted to go to conclusions of law number 7, where it says the EQB concludes that under the MOU, the expertise of the Commission, Commerce, DNR, and PCA provides the greatest expertise in analyzing the potential effects of the proposed projects. And I certainly agree with that. And I guess that's telling me that this expertise is based on all 4 of those organizations. So that's critical. So then we come down to the MOU, which is really critical to that relationship and that expertise. And in reading the MOU, I really have some questions about how that's outlined. And it talks about the assisting agencies, which would be the PCA and the DNR, agree to use best efforts to provide the staffing resources necessary to accomplish this MOU. So it talks about best efforts. I have a question about the best efforts, what actually that means. Also, the purpose of this MOU will be identified in a separate interagency funding agreement that designates the specific assistant agency staff assigned and the general scope of duties. I don't think we have seen that document, so I have a question about that. Also, under number, I'm talking about agency resources on the MOU. Mm-hmm. Under number 2, it talks about the lead agency will enter into a separate arrangement with the project proposers to cover the cost of environmental review for both proposed projects. So the lead agency controls the funding there. And then under number 3, all obligations of the lead agency and assistant agencies under this MOU are contingent upon the appropriation, allotment, or availability of funding sources for the work undertaken by the agencies. That leaves kind of an open in terms of funding. So I guess what I'm saying is I agree that the expertise is with those 4 agencies. My question is the MOU, it is not transparent. It doesn't give me enough information to really make a decision if the contribution of the PCA and the DNR does add the expertise needed for this decision. Mm-hmm. I guess it goes to the MOU.
There's a question. There's a question in there. There's a question in there somewhere, I think.
I would like clarification of the MOU, or expanded MOU, or the opportunity to come back to the MOU at some point is what I'd like.
Probably not necessarily for Courtney.
No.
But, keep in mind the board is also part of this broad-ranging discussion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have all of the same questions John has. And so my question was in terms of process today. Most of my questions would be probably for commissioners, and then I also have some questions for commission staff, PUC staff. And so I think Courtney knows the law very well and has given us a great outline, but I have some specific questions for others. So I'm kind of curious, are we going to hear from public and then have a bit of a board discussion? How is this going to
My hope, out? We have five folks that have requested an opportunity to testify. I think our questions should be directed to Courtney at this time, and if you have none, we'll excuse her. I think we know exactly what the lay of the land is, and we know obviously what the recommendation of the staff is, and so it's my hope that at some point during this meeting, probably closer to 4:00 than anything, that we will have a vote. We also have another item on the agenda that we would like to carve out some time for. So unless you have questions for Courtney, I think what I'd like to do is go directly to a public comment, and once that, have a general discussion around the table.
Oh,
and
okay.
If that seems satisfactory, I
will. So if we have other questions, that can
wait
till we're after.
We're going to have a vote today, so let's make sure we have enough time to have questions answered. So, Courtney, with that, thank you very much for a good job. Public comment. Willis, I'd like to start with you. Willis Mathiasen from Osage, Minnesota. And Willis has been active and involved in this process a long time. And so we're happy to see you today, Willis, and welcome to the EQB board. Six testifiers now. So, anyone else that wishes to have a chance to testify, please fill out the pink card and bring it forward, if you would, please.
Thank you, Chairman Fredrickson, and members of the EQB board. I first want to express my gratitude to all of you for hearing concerns that I've had voiced to me throughout the last 2.5 years of this process. And I want you to know that I do speak for a number of people when I voice these concerns. So thank you for allowing me to speak on their behalf. Oh, now I'm going to mess this up. Someone want to give me a cue here as to what I should be doing?
You know, and then this one will advance too, if that was
too
cumbersome.
Oh, that might be better. Thank you. I must say, citizens were disappointed that staff findings seemed to place at premium quantity of environmental review by the current RGU over the quality when judging expertise. You might recall, if you've waded through the voluminous report I gave you, I spent a great deal of time parsing through all of the kinds of expertise that are needed to perform quality environmental review, and found significant shortcomings. I might add that the Department of Commerce, who performs this on behalf of the PUC, has actually had very little in-depth experience with crude oil pipelines. Yes, they've done gas pipelines and power lines, and a crude oil pipeline has passed over their desk. But these were not full EISs, so it would be their first venture into a full EIS on a pipeline where they were sole RGU. The primary environmental review shortcomings were major in the previous exercise. For example, the Department of Commerce completely omitted as a issue in pipeline review and approval the matter of probably the greatest impact and public interest, and that is the factor of spills and leaks. Commerce has never seen the need, nor has it performed, a spill or a leak risk assessment, nor has it ever performed a worst-case scenario of a spill to fully portray what the consequences would be of an event that is becoming all too common with crude oil transportation via pipeline. And some of the more glaring shortcomings had to do with scoping. The responsibility of an RGU is to actually identify all and verify that no reasonable alternative to the project exists. Yet the process used by the PUC and Commerce puts that burden on parties other than the applicant and other than themselves So the burden rests on ordinary citizens to find, analyze, cost out, engineer, and provide all of the environmental data before your alternative can actually get on the table for serious consideration. Now, they're changing that process or proposing to change the process as they're going forward now, but there are still significant barriers being placed in front of these possible alternatives. And some of these barriers are virtually impossible to surmount by ordinary citizens. As case in point of what the Commerce Department PUC has found acceptable in terms of accepting an alternative, an administrative law judge, in response to my own testimony in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, challenged me as I said there should be more alternatives considered, asking me if I was willing and able to actually construct a pipeline along that route, and if not, my suggested alternative route was not going to be accepted into the docket. I found that astounding, but that might have been a misunderstanding on the part of the ALJ. However, no one from Commerce nor PUC staff rose to clarify that finding in the ALJ's report. To me, that signals probably the greatest single misunderstanding of environmental law, procedure, and how MEPA provides for evaluation of alternatives. One of the things that your very able staff advises in guidance documents to people preparing EISs is that it's common for an applicant to couch a proposal in a rather flowery purpose that no one could object to. Or they couch it in a purpose that serves their own needs, and that is accepted as a public need. That's been the case in the last two and about half years with this process. Even going into the current EIS draft, EAW, for the going into the EIS, Department of Commerce staff are comfortable going out into public and saying that the purpose of the project is to transport oil from North Dakota to Superior, when we all know that no one is using that oil in Superior. The project goes on elsewhere, and that has significant consequences on limiting possible alternatives. So adopting the applicant's private purpose has a significant constraining impact on what possible alternatives get on the table or included in the EIS. It demonstrates to me that the department is totally unfamiliar with the procedures of MEPA. They've operated within the PUC rules and the alternative rules for years. This is strange territory for them, and so they make these kinds of serious mistakes. Furthermore, the RGU has allowed the applicant to suspend and thus prohibit federal permits and federal environmental review, contrary to both NEPA and MEPA, where the admonition is always to collaborate and coordinate environmental review on all levels so that the resources and concerns that are possibly addressed on their level are also included and not come up as an issue at a later level. The applicant has suspended permit review by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Minnesota and has refused to make a final submission of data to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in North Dakota, each of which are poised to proceed with NEPA review, but that's suspended. The applicant is somehow able to control the process with the permission of the RGU. The Department of Commerce has failed to consult with neighboring states. I've talked to the people in Wisconsin. I've talked to the people in Michigan and talked to the people in North Dakota. None of them have had a contact from the Department of Commerce to say, what are your issues that a decision on our part of the border might have consequences for you on your side of the border and vice versa? MEPA requires that to be done. Yet, Commerce sees no need to do that. And probably the most embarrassing thing of all is that somehow this department has been treating Native Americans as though they're ordinary Minnesota citizens rather than governments on independent nations that happen to reside within the borders of our state. Federal law requires, and certainly state law would indicate, that these people deserve special attention and special audience and special recognition. Yet this process has forced these people to prove in court that they have an interest in off-reservation resources before their concerns are admitted as significant into the decision. Tribes, of course, are asserting treaty rights off-reservation, but no one is accepting that those rights apply, nor are they willing to say, yet we know you hunt, fish, and gather off the reservation, and so if these projects have possible impact on those things, by right and moral consideration of another people, we should look at that. Does our government have to be forced by law and an order of a judge to be considerate of a sovereign nation living within our borders? Why is this all so difficult to talk about, especially when the truth is staring us right in the face? I prepared a rather elegant presentation for today on regulatory capture, and I even sent you a special copy in case you missed it in the packet, because it is what I would call a cancer on the process of regulation. That's not just unique here, it's everywhere. And all agencies must take efforts to combat it, because there are methods by which it can be held at bay. You don't eliminate it. But at 6 o'clock this morning, I changed my mind. So I'm rather ill-prepared to do what I'm about to do. I'm going to speak less from my head than I am from my heart. I'll show you that presentation sometime if you're interested, by the way. I actually think it's quite good. It might bore you to death, but right now I'll save you that. I realize that at my age, and I am coming up 74, that I will probably never have this audience again to say what I need to say, based on the many years of experience I've had, both as a citizen and as a regulator and a participant in a regulatory agency, because I've seen the situation from both sides. So let's have a real conversation about that. Government truth-telling is a national embarrassment. Truth-telling by government agencies has become increasingly difficult when huge sums of money and power are involved. The larger the amount of money, the harder it is to tell the truth, especially about the risks. Natural resources and human health are regularly and knowingly placed at risk in exchange for money and power. I'm not telling you anything new. The public has a great deal of difficulty finding out who's behind these kinds of snafus. As a former government agency, I speak with some considerable authority and personal experience. We all know that powerful legislators hold agencies' budgets and authorities hostage to gain special treatment for pet projects. Important protective or restorative programs are held hostage in return for concessions elsewhere. Agency employees who risk telling the truth do so at the peril of their career advancement or even their jobs. We can all name individuals who have paid the price for telling the powers that be the inconvenient truth. Countless more courageous public servants just slink away quietly, and the public never even knows what happened to them. National scandal after national scandal is based on this principle. 60 Minutes makes a living exposing them. Do we really think the American electorate has not seen enough of this? Is not the current political upheaval playing out on the national stage all a citizen uprising in response to government dysfunction? Are we content to continue being a part of the problem instead of being a part of the solution? Can we find a way to allow this EIS, and I say allow this EIS to speak the truth to power? The environmental consequences of this project are simply too large. The economic consequences are major. The political consequences too are large. Climate change consequences may actually be huge. The livability of our planet could be at stake, and government credibility itself is at stake. More precisely, the integrity of MEPA. That single most powerful law, whether NEPA on national level or MEPA on the state level, is the single most powerful tool citizens and agencies have to protect and restore the human and natural environment. We're putting that tool at jeopardy if we allow shoddy environmental review to shield the truth. The actual relevance of you as an EQB board is at stake, because if you oversee this kind of work that undermines the purpose of MEPA, you might as well fade away into irrelevance, because of what public interest is your work if you cannot have a document that tells the truth? We dare not fail. Most citizens have faith in Governor Dayton to support sound science, such as in the PolyMet EIS and the current Red River Flood Control EIS that DNR has just released, and on other important environmental projects. The governor has taken some courageous stances on protecting and improving Minnesota lakes and streams when presented with the truth about the quality of those streams and rivers. He was prepared to take political risks, but he's got to be given the correct information to stand on when he goes out and takes those risks and takes the heat. I don't believe that Governor Dayton has been told the truth, nor has anyone else for that matter. I don't claim to know the truth about this project. I want the EIS to reveal what my misgivings, my false beliefs, my misunderstandings might be, but I also want it to affirm those which I believe to be true. We want it to speak the truth. So what steps can the UQB take to ensure the EIS speaks this inconvenient truth for the governor, for the citizens, and for the industry itself? Because I don't believe the industry itself and the people who make it up. I've gotten to know some of these people personally. Paul Eberth and I have great conversations. We even talk about going hunting or fishing sometime together. I want to meet his daughter that he takes out into the duck blind, and she shoots ducks with him. They don't get to tell you those kinds of things in these business meetings, but he and I have gotten to know each other quite well. I believe they would like their project built on truth, not on a lie. So here are some suggested steps. Your staff has recommended you deny the change in RGU, and maybe you see fit to affirm that. But that doesn't solve the problem, and there may be ways to do it, but I would hope that you would grant the request, or I would not have made it. But alternatively, as commissioners have pointed out and questioned, the MOU could be amended to achieve a parity amongst the agencies with Commerce as fiscal administrators, because the problem I see with the MOU is that it places the other agencies in a subservient position to the lead agency. Prior to the MOU, these other agencies were free to comment in public and did so rather strongly and made some powerful arguments that Commerce ignored. But we knew that because their letters were in public. I enclosed some of them in the packet, so you get to see what great differences there were between agencies. With the MOU, that access by the public to those differences goes away. And if Commerce maintains the positions they have with the PCA and DNR, they rule because they have ultimate power. They're subservient. The other agencies are subservient. They're not peers. They're not equals. And even the dispute resolution has problems. Ask me about it, and I'll tell you later. You could instruct the RGUs to employ independent panels of outside experts as is provided for in the Environmental Policy Act, actually required. Could require the convening of citizen advisory panels for ongoing role in the EIS to provide more transparency where the MOU was closing it, and to build consensus outcomes that avoid delays or renewed lawsuits if everything goes wrong. It could require reissuance of the RFP. The Department of Commerce has already selected the consultant for this project before the scoping is done. Does that actually then anticipate the width, depth, and breadth of the scope so you know the consultant they have on board is satisfactory? Or would it not have been wise to figure out what the scope was going to be and then went out and got the necessary consulting expertise to perform it? That baffles me. No EIS I've ever been involved in did that way. So an extra request for proposals for special consultant work, especially on risk assessment and worst-case scenarios. There are experts out there, especially with Keystone XL, did excellent work, and they've been recommended. We'd hope those consultants who know how to do this will be hired. It's a very highly specialized field. And then the EIS could be utilized as a long-term planning tool, as the PCA suggested in one of the first letters. Minnesota was ill-prepared for the North Dakota oil boom, and we didn't anticipate what was coming our way. To the credit of the Department of Commerce, Department of Employment and Economic Development, they saw it coming. They hired a consultant, and they prepared a report how Minnesota could take economic advantage of the oil boom, but no such similar report was prepared about what were going to be the environmental threats to the oil boom in North Dakota. If Commerce is a responsible RGU with expertise in this affair, one would have thought they'd have been matching Department of Economic Development in taking advantage of the early notice of this huge development on our doorstep, but they did not. I think there should be a formalist collaboration established with the neighboring states that I mentioned that was failed to do before. There should be a collaborative relationship with federal units, including the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. EPA, to coordinate NEPA and MEPA. And there should be a formal, respectful, and diplomatic intergovernmental relation established with Native American tribes and tribal member groups, giving them a direct role in the EIS, similar and as though they were another federal agency, which in fact they are. So I want to give you a special thank you. I took longer than I thought I would. I want a special thank you to Will and Courtney for accommodating and giving citizens extraordinary access to key members of the EQB board. We've met several times with the subcommittee of the board, and now I've appeared before you several times to voice our concerns. So thank you for your willingness to hear citizens' complaint. I do humbly regret that I may not have been fully up to the challenge that I have had placed in front of me. But I want to tell you where I'm going to be tomorrow afternoon. I'm going to be in a boat with two of my grandsons. And after having said what I said here today, I'm going to sit a little taller in that boat seat than I could if I had not said what I said today. Because this is a picture of my son, his wife, and my grandson, Taylor, who just graduated from University of Wisconsin Superior with a degree in fisheries biology. And I had to share with him, that's Taylor, the story just made NPR News about the fish kill on the Whitewater River last year, because he and his dad were, guess what, next week planning a trip to the Whitewater River. And I said, you might want to reconsider because the population is significantly lower. And he said, what happened? I said, I'll send you the news article. And I said, in the news article, you will see DNR fisheries biologists sampling trout, measuring trout, doing population surveys. And I said, Taylor, That's the kind of work I hope that you're going to do someday, but I hope that that is never the cause, that you have to examine the loss and cause of 10,000 trout in a premier trout stream in Minnesota. So I want to, when I go home today and fish in that boat with Taylor and my other grandson Corey tomorrow, I want to be able to look them in the eye and tell them I did what I could do. And I want each one of you to think of who's back home right now when you go back home. And you tell them about your decision today. Will you be able to sit tall in that boat seat next to them and claim what you did here today? Or is this going to be another one of those times when we said, well, maybe sometime, but not this time? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Willis. And on the contrary, you indeed did rise to the occasion, and as usual, you did it with class and great style. And so enjoy the fishing trip with your grandkids and sit tall in the seat. Thank you. Chuck Diesner, please. Welcome, Mr. Diesner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please have a chair.
I couldn't picture
it. And if you would, identify yourself for the record, even though I have identified you already.
My name is Chuck Diesner. I live in Park Rapids on one of the local lakes that is threatened by the Sandpiper Pipeline. I have attended. My background was I was an attorney in Minneapolis, retired. That's the best thing that ever happened to me. Did real estate development and very familiar with environmental laws, have never been involved in anything dealing with utilities. I took a great interest in this situation. I've attended all the hearings, I've read all the documents, and I'm appalled. And I hope that the facts that have been given to you, and I really do hope, because there's a tremendous amount of material, that you've read the information, particularly from the citizens, about what has been going on by the DOC and by the PUC to a certain extent. If somebody told me that I would be sitting here today saying what I'm saying, I would have told them they're crazy. And Commissioner Saxhog, you hit the nail right on the head. I'm going to do something, well, let me do it this way. I'm going to start out with my conclusion. And I hope you will consider adopting this alternative to address this problem without having to wait for another month. I think it was Courtney that pointed us to conclusion 7, which says the EQB concludes that under the MOU, the expertise, etc., you can read the rest. My solution for this project is get rid of that damn document. And I'll explain to you why. So as you listen to my comments, when I started this process, I wanted the PUC and the DOC thrown out. And I knew that was a huge mountain to climb, but I thought we had the facts to do it. But in sitting back, and I thank the staff, Will Seifert and his staff, Courtney, because they gave me a different way of looking at this through their findings of fact. And I think we can use their work, as far as I'm concerned, to approach the problem differently. And I'd like to have the resolution be, we have a RGU right now that is the PUC with one agent and that's the DOC, and we have two other agencies shoved over in the corner. Maybe they'll participate, maybe they won't. That's the current RGU. I'm suggesting that the new RGU be the PUC with three agents. Leave the DOC there, add the MPCA, and add the DNR. That solves the reason why we're here. We, the public, and as you as members of the EQB, should not trust, that's a horrible thing to say, you should not trust the DOC. They haven't earned anybody's confidence that they're doing things correctly. You know as well as everybody, they're supposed to advocate for the public best interest. Quickly, let's think about what they did. When they're supposed to report to the PUC about what routes to consider, they purposely ignored what the DNR and the MPCA recommended. It wasn't even included. Secondly, the PUC was upset with them and said, you better get this right. We rely on both those agencies. We need their expertise. We respect them. We respect their views. We need them in this process to make a decision. So include them in the environmental report that you're going to do. As I said at the last time I testified, you know what the DOC did? They didn't involve them at all. How can that happen? Okay. Let me go through. So as you think about my comments, think about this different solution. That solves all the problems. Because now the DOC cannot run roughshod. Back in the corner, all by itself, where the public doesn't know what's going on. Because now we got two other agencies that are going to protect our interest. So we're here today because the public doesn't trust the DOC anymore, and it never will trust the DOC under its current management for the EERA. There's something going on here that I don't understand as a professional or as a citizen. And nobody's ever offered an explanation. So our goal, this whole process, was to restore confidence in the public and have an independent, comprehensive, honest EIS. Okay. Let's talk about who has the greatest expertise. If you look at the DOC, the PUC, just pull them aside. They can't do an EIS. They don't have the staff. They've never done it. All they've ever done is read it. So they can't perform. That's like saying that somebody that reads Golf Digest and is an expert on the swing off the tee can go out and do it. Yeah, that's not right. They analyze the reports. They do not do the work. They're not qualified. So where do they go? They go to the DOC. What's the DOC's background? Well, there's a whole bunch of flowery stuff that was put in the report. But what are we talking about in this EIS? It involves water resources, and it involves oil. The DOC has never been involved in those circumstances. Who has? The DNR. Commissioner Landwehr just completed a EIS, his agency for the water diversion project. The DNR knows water. They're in control of our water resources. The DOC doesn't know water. They don't know oil pipelines. They know power lines. Power lines are not oil pipelines. Next, if you look at the MPCA, their expertise was put out in the findings of fact. But you know what they know about, and it was in Willis's? They know about spills. They know about contamination. They know about remediation. They know about damage. DOC doesn't know anything about that. Those are the critical issues under the CIS. Let's, I want to address Commissioner Sackhog's appropriate comments regarding the MOU. The MOU is a bunch of words. That's all it is. It says that specific staffing needs to accomplish the purpose of the MOU will be identified in a separate interagency funding agreement. Well, isn't that convenient? That gives the DOC the right to go in the room and shut the door so nobody can see. And guess who else is in the room with the DOC? The pipeline companies. And they don't want to pay any more than they have to. So the DOC, I'm sad to say, can use an agreement with the pipeline companies not to pay the amount of money they should have to pay to reduce the amount of investigation that goes on in this process. It's been done up to date. Their actions to date indicate no change. And I can't believe anybody thinks that they will change. I'm not much of a believer in words. I operate from action. Let's look at the other things that are said here. All the obligations under the MOU, this is the key language. This addresses Commissioner Sacksog's exact concern. This is real nice about all the stuff that they may do, but it's may do because all obligations of the lead agency and assisting agencies are contingent upon appropriation, allotment, and availability of funding sources. Well, who's going to negotiate that? The DOC in the closet with the pipeline companies. So there's no assurance that the DNR or MPCA is going to be involved, or if they are, that they'll be involved in any meaningful way. Now, there's another concern I have under the MOU. I think it violates MEPA. And I'll tell you why. I get my fingers to work. The MOU restricts what the agencies can do. The interdisciplinary preparation obligation under MEPA lays out what the agencies should do, and they have carte blanche authority to do everything. The MOU says, oh no, it's contingent on funding. That's not consistent with Minnesota Rule 4410-2200. The RGU may request another governmental unit to help in the completion of the EIS. Governmental units shall provide any unprivileged data or information to which it has reasonable access, etc. You can read the rest. There is no restriction. It has the agencies providing everything that they've got to help the process. Okay. Let me, I've got some, a proposed revised conclusion of law, just one paragraph, and a revised order, which is pretty simple to read.
I know.
I've got six more behind okay. you, so if
okay. I will, you can, I'm going to wrap it up.
Okay, here. Thank you very much, and I apologize for even having to raise it. But
I can come back after you've got questions. That's fine.
Go ahead.
Well, I think when you read this, I've already done paragraph 7 because I took out the MOU. The MOU is the problem. The order is exactly the way the order was written, except I added at the end of the first paragraph that the new RGU will be with the DNR and the MPCA and Department of Commerce as its agents. Then I go on and say that it's further ordered that they be co-authors of the EIS. Now, I know when this idea was brought up to have a number of parties as the agent to prepare the EIS, the Department of Commerce went, oh, this is going to be so hard. It's going to be so hard. We can't do that. Do you really believe that? Our whole society works on cooperation and collaboration of people. If we can't have our Department of Commerce and our DNR and our MPCA figure out how to jointly write an EIS, we got bigger problems than we're talking about right here. The only reason the DOC doesn't want it, you know, out of, you can fill in the rest. They don't want anybody looking over their shoulder. And then I talk about what would be involved in all this. I don't know all the administrative sides of this, but I leave that up to the three agents in the PUC. And then I further say that the MOU is terminated. I think this is a much better way. You don't have to reach a conclusion about the exact acts of the PUC, the acts of the DOC, because that stuff's over with. If you pass my proposed resolution, we don't have DOC out there running around doing what it plans, whatever it plans on doing. Now, the other, Mr. Chairman, the other document I have is I took the liberty of marking up the findings of fact. I've got change pages. There's only about 5, and there's a few words. So I'm happy to go through that with you, but I'll step aside for now, and I can come back later.
All right.
Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Deesner at this point? Seeing none, thank you very much. You're
going
to stick around for the balance of the meeting. So.
I don't think he does.
Well, if the conclusions are that way, then he does.
Okay.
And also, hopefully, Willis, you'll be available for other questions. And the same goes to each of the remaining testifiers. I'd like to ask John Munter. Thank you. Please come forward, John, and identify yourself for the record. Welcome to the Environmental Quality Board.
Mr. Chairman, board members, my name is John Munter. I live near Warba, Minnesota, which is near Grand Rapids, Minnesota. This should only take about 5 minutes or so.
Grand Rapids is a suburb of Warba, if I believe. No comment out of Saxog over here.
I want to first say that I was shocked, as most of us were last year, when we found that the PUC and the DOC and the ALJ, the judge, totally ignored the comments of the DNR and the PCA in terms of their routing of the pipelines. They didn't like the preferred routing of Enbridge, and they said so in writing, and we were literally shocked that they received no response to that at all. The EQB staff response to this matter, I think, is a perfect example of unconscious regulatory capture. Since they assume the Enbridge segmentation gambit, I mean, obviously the oil is not stopping in Superior, Wisconsin. It's going farther on. It's going to the East Coast. It's going to the Gulf. It's going to Midwest refineries. Line 61 is a $1.2 million project, barrels per day project in Wisconsin. It's not quite permitted yet, which goes down to the Flanagan South. So the oil will either go under the Mackinac Straits, or it will go to Midwest refineries, or it will go down the Flanagan South pipeline, which just became permitted itself in 2014. It's a 600,000 barrel per day pipeline that had no environmental review, no EIS, no public comment even, because they segmented it out into 2,000 little segments. Amazingly, they used a gambit called the Nationwide Permit 12, which allowed a study of a small segment, and it was just really an inappropriate way to do it, but they got away with it. From Cushing, then, from Oklahoma, Enbridge bought the Seaway pipeline going down to Houston in 2011, and then they expanded it. And they're also looking to expand it to go into Port Arthur, Texas. So obviously this oil is going all the way from Alberta to the Gulf and other places as a holistic plan. The PCA has permitted a lot of pipelines in Minnesota, but this pipeline project operates under MEPA that PCA is the expert at, not the PUC, which requires also detailed analysis from where the oil begins and to where it finishes, from Alberta to the Gulf and to eastern refineries. Furthermore, it requires tremendous analysis that the PCA and the DNR have the tools and the experience to do. And the item number 76 you find in your packet there of the EQB findings, the EQB finds the DNR Lands and Minerals Division coordinates review for utilities that cross state or public lands and issues licenses to cross public waters and state lands managed by the DNR. So the DNR operates interstate. In the next comment, I want to mention number 78 says the EQB finds the PCA has expertise in the regulatory oversight for the construction, installation, and operation of pipelines, tank terminals, refineries, which may require MPCA permits for air quality, above ground storage tanks, wastewater, stormwater, and Section 401 water quality certification. This is huge expertise that we need outside of Minnesota, from Alberta to the Gulf, that the PUC doesn't have, that the PCA does have. another comment I want to make on number 79 of the findings here. The DNR and PCA state in March 25th, 2016 joint letter to the EQB executive director that the two agencies have resource-specific permitting authority, but quote-unquote. And then it goes on to say, neither PMPCA or the DNR has such a singular regulatory role to play that warrants removing the RGU status from the PUC. Well, they do. They have tremendous resource-specific permitting authority, which is exactly what's needed to look at all these EISs that go through all these states from the Gulf all the way up to Alberta, as well as having the MEPA expertise. Also, somebody needs to ride herd on Department of Commerce as well. So it'd be good if we had to do away with MOU, because the Department of Commerce has a problem as well. The faulty Minnesota segmentation concept is shown up most disastrously in the stranded assets doctrine. Unless you widen your purview from Enbridge contracts just through Minnesota to include Alberta and North Dakota and the international oil market, you don't realize that these pipelines are intended to sell their stranded assets at a loss, which is what they're doing now. Selling assets at a loss is no public purpose, but it's a private purpose. And we've had this big issue with we're only recognizing the private purpose in these scoping documents so far. There is no public purpose. It's better for stranded assets to make some money than to make no money, right? But eminent domain should not be employed for a private purpose. A stranded assets doctrine begins with Saudi Arabia, which is pumping at a profit, but which has more oil than they can ever burn. And they realize that. And so they know it, and they're going to continue pumping it. They see, I mean, this, their countries are going to be almost unlivable in a few years. And they absolutely realize the problem of too much carbon in this world. Saudi stranded assets selling at a cheap price are forcing sale of North American stranded assets at a loss. This is not a public purpose to permit pipelines. This is a bankruptcy problem. So commerce should not be satisfied with just Minnesota contracts. Put the PCA in charge, or at least give them equal billing, equal power, do away with MOU or something, but at least give some equality and status. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Munter. Mr. Sattinger? Stan is here. There he is. Okay. Welcome. And please identify yourself for the record, Mr. Sattinger.
I'm Stan Sattinger. I'm a retired mechanical engineer. I live in South Minneapolis. I'm... thank you, Chairman Frederickson and members of the EQB for allowing me this chance to testify. I'm a latecomer to this process, but I'm testifying out of concern that arose after I commented at the May 9th hearing on the scoping of the EISs. I understand there's to be two separate EISs, so I'll try to speak in plural about that. My concern is that there's, to me, an obvious conflict of interest on the part of the PUC and the Department of Commerce in that they have demonstrated a concern for the welfare of big business in comparison with any expressed indication of concern about the environment. My belief is that the DNR and the PCA by themselves do have the expertise to be appropriate overseers of the EIS process. I'd like to talk about the comments that I did offer at the May 9th hearing on the scoping of the EISs. I talked about the risk of uncontrolled methane release due to the melting of permafrost being an unacceptable risk to all humans and all other life forms. I presented some information to the effect that, and this is about the feedback cycle of increasing temperature, melting more permafrost, releasing more methane, which raises the temperature further, which melts more permafrost. So what's that got to do about the Sandpiper and the Line 3 replacement? Well, what would initiate this feedback, this out-of-control feedback cycle to occur is the gradual elevation in global temperature, which is upon us and which is happening. And there's a threshold that we're not that far away from. I mentioned a publication, a scientific publication, that indicates if the global climate warms another few tenths of a degree, a large expanse of the Siberian permafrost will start to melt uncontrollably. And we are steadily approaching this irreversible tipping point. Again, what's this got to do with the case before the PUC on these two pipelines. What I asked for is that the EISs for these projects should forecast the increase in global average temperature. I'm saying that these two pipelines are not the only activities in the world that are contributing to the raising of temperatures, but they're significant. That the EIS should address and quantify the increase in global average temperature due to the emissions of carbon dioxide due just to the pipeline operations, the flow of the 1.1 million barrels per day of conveyed crude oil over the lifetimes of these proposed pipelines. And then I asked that the EIS would use this projected warming to assess the project's likelihood of contributing to permafrost melting. So my thoughts afterward were, if Commerce and PUC would be dominating the decision, what are the chances that this crucial issue that faces all mankind and all living things in the world will be kept in the scope of the EIS for these two projects that will convey a huge amount of oil that will contribute to this triggering of runaway, unstable release of methane? What my concern comes down to is, if the PUC and the DOC are kept as parties of the RGU, what happens in any disagreement with DNR and PCA? Which agency wins? So my conclusion is, again, Sandpiper and Line 3 aren't the only environmental issues of our time, but their impacts will be significant and they will be predictable. I have no suggested rewrites or resolutions to offer, but I conclude and I persuade you that we can't afford to leave out this critical issue due to conflicts of interest. And I believe that PUC and Commerce should not be kept as parties to the RGU or as parties of the RGU. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Sattinger. The next four testifiers are all from Honor the Earth, and I'm wondering if all four of you would be willing to come up and participate as a group. I'm trying to expedite just a little bit. If not, Thane Maxwell, come on up and please identify yourself for the record.
We're happy to all come up.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what.
I took your silence as indicating that you weren't happy to come up, but
it sounded fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always fun when Ms. LaDuke is here. So, Courtney, there's enough chairs there. So, let's.
Why don't you pass that again?
I'd like to ask you, first of all, please, to identify yourself for the record, Thane. And Corey and Winona and Bill. So if you could just do that for the record and make your comments, and we'll just go on down the line.
Sure. Good afternoon, Thane Maxwell, Thane Maxwell. Sorry, did you want everyone's introduction?
Oh, they can do it in order. So go ahead and make your comments if you wish.
I wrote mine out this time.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. It seems like Willis and Chuck and others have covered the technical stuff, so I'm going to take a bit of a broader view. I look around Minnesota, and this is what I see. 90% of our wetlands have been drained. The rivers, lakes, and streams in the southern half of the state are unfit to even swim in. We can only eat one fish a week, much less if you're a small child or pregnant mother. We spend hundreds of millions a year on environmental stewardship, and still we destroy more than we restore. We've slaughtered thousands of wolves. We've decimated the moose population. Giant white pines are long gone, and now many of the most productive maple forests have been clear-cut. More than half of the wild rice, our state grain, and the sacred food of our indigenous people is gone. And evidently, we're now so busy working on the details of how exactly to weaken the wild rice sulfate standard, which has never even been enforced, that we are unable to even do the basic job of overseeing permits for the existing mines. And yet, despite seeing all the devastation our mismanagement has caused, despite seeing the human conflict and disaster caused by climate change, despite watching up to 200 species go extinct every day, despite undeniable evidence that we must leave fossils in the ground in order to avoid catastrophic destruction of our own habitat, we continue to pursue short-sighted economic development through the construction of new fossil fuel infrastructure. A couple years of jobs that go mostly to workers brought in from other states. Surely no one among you actually believes that is sound policy. Every day, right now, over 2.5 million barrels of crude oil flow through our state in 8 pipelines. 4 of those lines, Enbridge's old lakehead system, are ancient and full of holes, likely with Superfund sites sitting underneath them. They were built in the 50s and 60s before anyone knew what we were getting into. At many points, those pipes were never buried and are sitting above ground, corroding with their protective polyethylene coating peeling off. We have some pictures here, and I'll come give them to you in just a second. This peeling is what caused the Kalamazoo rupture. 6 years and $1.2 billion spent, still not cleaned up. These lines are catastrophes waiting to happen right now. This is a public policy crisis right now. It's a public health crisis, and no one is doing anything about it. Now Enbridge wants to start abandoning these lines and just walk away. We've been kicking and screaming about this for over a year, and we've yet to see a single agency or official take any action whatsoever. Minnesota has no plan and is on the brink of an unprecedented but precedent-setting corporate handout, disguised as part of the new Line 3 construction application that will pass up an incredible job creation opportunity and pass on an unfathomable liability to our children. Now Enbridge and the Koch brothers want to expand their networks to nearly double the amount of oil flowing through here, adding an additional 2 million barrels a day. Enbridge has chosen a new route through our most delicate aquatic ecosystems. Some of our biggest and best lakes, our most vulnerable soils, our shallowest aquifers, and some of the largest wild rice beds in the world. They chose it specifically to skirt around the Indian reservations in an attempt to avoid conflicts with the tribes and the feds. And if they get this new corridor, we have every reason to assume that they will put 6 or more lines in it, abandon their other dinosaurs, and build them all anew. How do they plan to do that to us? Part of how it works is through fragmentation. They divide it all up into separate lines, each one with a project purpose defined as getting product from point A to point B. And then the boundaries of state jurisdiction fragment it even further, as each state puts on its blinders to ignore everything happening outside the imaginary lines. The assumptions are never questioned. The only federal agency with interstate regulatory power is literally a rubber stamp machine with nearly 100% approval rate. Then the states each do their part. Minnesota fragments the responsibility of oversight among 4 or 5 agencies, and everyone passes the buck, and at the end of the day, no one is accountable. This is a magic trick of the highest order. What we end up with is a government full of good, smart, hardworking people like yourselves. People with the best intentions of stewarding our environment and public well-being, but an institutional structure that utterly fails at that task. This is what Willis calls regulatory capture. The current process is a perfect example of this failure. We just spent an enormous amount of time and energy documenting for you the fact that the DOC is out of its league and unfit for this task, and you are ignoring us. I cannot stress to you enough how dysfunctional this process continued to be. As it goes on, I'm literally watching moderate, middle-aged, white, middle-class people get radicalized. people that genuinely believe in the system, believe that public participation and good governance is possible, are losing that faith. We drive around the North testifying, and most of what we say is ignored. At this last round of 13 DOC scoping meetings, we were asked to comment on a project with a purpose defined as getting oil to Superior. But the maps included alternative routes that don't even go to Superior. And when I pointed out to the Cardinal project manager that this was very confusing for the public, are these routes being considered or not? She told me that, yes, they realized they probably got that purpose statement wrong, and that the reason they did is that they were rushed, that they had asked for an extension and that the governor denied it. I said, yeah, we feel really rushed too. Several of us pointed out the problems with those purpose statements in the hearings, and they gave us a variety of responses depending on the night. At one point, we were told that there would be two EISs eventually, each with different purpose definitions, but that they would be different than they were in the draft once we got to the final. So now we've finished the public participation part of the scoping process without most people being clear on whether there is one EIS or two, and without anyone being clear about what the definitions of the project actually are, projects that supposedly warrant condemnation of private land through eminent domain. What a mess. The fact is, Enbridge is one of the most dishonest and destructive corporations in the world. I've listened to pipeline workers tell me horror story after horror story about dealing with them. I've listened to landowners do the same. We could fill an encyclopedia just summarizing their scandals and lawsuits and cover-ups, explosions, and negligent spill responses. A couple weeks ago, they pulled out 825 tons of contaminated soil left over from a one-barrel spill back in the 80s. Nobody is watching. It's tragic to me that we feel dependent on these companies for jobs. How did we get trapped in such an abusive relationship? How did we convince ourselves we need to poison our own water so that they can make a few more billion? We found ourselves in quite a predicament. Willis calls it regulatory capture. I call it a political, economic, ecological, and moral crisis. And like it or not, each of you has signed up for the task of addressing that crisis. When your grandkids ask you someday, what did you do when that crisis became clear? What are you going to say? This pipeline process is an opportunity to do something. You may not change the RGU today, but we're asking you to do something. We're not asking you to change the world. We're asking you to find a way to set up a structure that will give us a high-quality EIS and let the data speak for itself. Deep down, I think you know as well as I do that it will show these projects are a bad idea for all of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Shane, for your passionate testimony.
Can I show you these photos?
Oh, sure.
These are the exposed lines on the Fond du Lac Reservation that I'm talking about.
Okay. If you can just pass them around. And again, the description of them is, again?
These are exposed Enbridge pipelines, crude oil pipelines on the Fond du Lac Reservation.
Okay. Very good. I'd like to go to Corey. And if you could please identify yourself for the record.
Corey Northrup, K-O-R-E-Y. Northrup, N-O-R-T-H-R-U-P. I reside on the Fond du Lac Indian Reservation and am an enrolled member. And I like to say the exposed lines that you're looking at right now happen to be where I harvest maple syrup every year. And, you know, my kids come through there and, like, the community comes to visit us and learn. And it's really concerning on what it is that's out there and what we're dealing with as far as, like, you know, what are they going to do with that? What's going to happen, you know, next? And worrying that it could be poisoned right now, you know, in the groundwater, and that's what goes into the maple trees, which is what we give as, you know, to our elders and our community members. So it's really concerning to me, you know, when they say they're supposed to be underground and they are obviously not underground. And destroying wetlands is like really not a great idea either. Since they go through the wetlands and they say they stay underground and there they are in the wetlands, not underground, can obviously not believe what they say. So I support the citizens' request for designating a different RGU for the Sandpiper and Line 3. the Department of Commerce hasn't conducted a worst-case scenario risk assessment for pipeline spills, and we've seen that in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which is the largest land oil spill that in our nation's history. What I want to know is what's going to happen to us as people if we don't have our wild rice and our medicines and our maple syrup and those rights that we retain in our treaties. So with that being said, thank you.
Thank you, Corey. Ms. LeDuc, welcome. Bill, welcome.
I'm going to actually defer to Mr. Wadle because I'm testifying on behalf of the 1855 Treaty Authority.
Okay. Bill Wadle, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I've been involved in this process a little over a year. I've been involved in politics and issues relating to Minnesota natural resources for many, many years. But my thought is this, that there's all kinds of awards that are given out. But I think what we're looking at here is the award for the dumbest move by a state in the union. We've spent billions of dollars developing Minnesota pollution control, taxpayer dollars, over 30-some years. Developing an agency with a responsibility to protect the environment of this state. And now we decide that we're going to take a very small agency, Department of Commerce, and say to them, you have to conduct this work. That makes no sense. None at all. No matter how you want to look at it, no matter how you want to rationalize it, it makes absolutely no sense for the citizens of Minnesota and the protection of the environment, which is what we're looking at. We're looking at an issue that can cause significant problems with the environment. And as such, we have to think about that. Why would we develop this huge agency to put somewhere else? It does not make sense. And I think that's a decision you really are faced with today, is why did we do that with all this taxpayer money? Why did we present and create this agency with all these experts, all these highly trained people within Minnesota Pollution Control, and not rely on their skills and their abilities and go to someone that's supposed to now develop a new agent or department within their agency to do environmental review? We talk about waste in government, but we're creating another agency to do environmental work when we already have one. It's illogical. So I really want you to think about that. I think that's a significant thing in our progress of dealing with these issues. In regards to the pipeline itself, there are a number of things. The first one is that I'd like to present is environmental justice. These pipelines were laid in areas where the biggest impacts are tribal communities. The reason that has happened is partially because of state law that says things that could potentially cause harm should be placed farther away from people, which in some sense makes sense. But no minority community should bore the undue burden of the whole responsibility, which is what's happening. And it can't be avoided by the fact that, oh, we didn't touch a reservation. Tribal communities have huge problems with health and stress on their communities, and this pipeline is adding to that. And as a result, they have to readjust their budgets to accompany the health issues that are increasing very dramatically. And mega projects like this pipeline are forcing significant additional health problems for tribal people. And in 2014, your Department of Health, through the Commissioner's Office, issued a legislative report to the state legislature stating that of all the minority groups, Native people have the highest health problems, highest risk. And it went on further to say that this isn't because of some genetic issue. This isn't because of some lifestyle. This is because social and economic conditions were established through law that place these people in this position. They further stated that structural racism within the laws of the state of Minnesota have forced these conditions and that the legislature should look at those. When this was presented, issues about environmental justice, the Department of Commerce has no ability to review environmental justice issues. They don't have staff trained to do that. MPCA is just developing staff to do that. And so these things need to be looked at and thought about. The next issue I'd like to raise is the issue of the cost of these pipelines to the citizens of Minnesota. Annually, if the citizens of Minnesota had to pay for the removal of the carbon that these pipelines are going to emit eventually, because it's going to be transported, it's going to go to a refinery, we're going to burn it, and it's going to release carbon. It would amount to about $46,000 for every person in the state of Minnesota to pay for the cost of cleaning that carbon up. Now, we can all say, well, it's going into the environment, and so we all bore the cost. If we release all the tar sands in Alberta, that amounts to about $4,600 for every man, woman, and child we'll have to pay to clean that up. That's a lot of money for some people. And it's a really lot of money for somebody to make a couple hundred billion dollars and expose all of us to those environmental issues. And that's what this is all about. How much can we bore? The last person talked about, you know, the effects of methane and permafrost. All of these things are facing us, and they're at a huge, huge, significant level. And if anybody doesn't believe that, you just got to get outside a little more because you'll observe it really fast. You're going to see tremendous fluctuations in temperature, in conditions on this planet, and we have to address those, and we have to start dealing with those. And we can't deal with that through the Department of Commerce. They're not the agency to do that. Two other things, and I'll be quiet. One is, whatever you do, you have to establish some process for the abandonment of these pipes in some future point. The present system of abandonment is, oh, yeah, that was ours, and we're done with it, so you take care of it. Because we're closing the ends, and whatever happens to it is now whoever's there gets to deal with that. You can't let this new pipeline, if it ever should be allowed to be built, have a system where our children have to face how you're going to deal with that. This has to be resolved before that. Everybody has to know how you're going to treat that. And finally, I think we have to look at the alternative routes of this pipeline, which is part of the problem with the last whole process was nobody wanted to do that. And they wanted preferred routes. Well, maybe preferred routes aren't the routes that should be. So with that, thank you for your time. Thank you for your understanding and patience.
Is Thank you very much, Don. I think I misspoke and called you Bill. I was looking at Bill Grant, and so I got both of you right, Bill Wadle. So for the record, the previous speaker was indeed Don Wadle. Ms. LeDuc? Welcome.
Thank you, Miigwech. Ani nindinoy magrindak nikagwe kitamagas bine sikwe ergo makwando deyam kapabani kaagish kanaganing indunjaba nishnave aking indunjaba. I'm from a place north of here. That's where I'm from. I came down here to see you guys today because it's important to visit with you. You guys have an opportunity to do something good. And you are the people who are going to make that decision. And so we came far from far away. A lot of the people in this room came from far away because we see that you have the opportunity to do something good for the future. So we're asking you to do that. Where I come from up north and the further north, if you get out a little more, sometimes I get the impression you guys don't get out much. I don't know if that's true. I mean, like today, did you notice it's like a stunning day out? Did y'all notice that?
Perfect.
And I see where we're all hanging out. And if you do a lot of this, you'd kind of miss in the big stuff out there, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what we're thinking about. And what I know is that the territory that I live in is what's known as the 1855 Treaty Area. It's an agreement my ancestors made with your ancestors. Those are the laws that we all agreed to live by in the state of Minnesota. And in that territory, that's where they want to put this. There's about 25,000 of us in Anishinaabe. I'm just one of the many, including the 1855 Treaty Authority. Can you make that not ding? Adds a little bit to it, though, right? The 1855 Treaty Authority, which represents that territory. And so we're really pretty concerned about the decisions that are being made and who's going to make those decisions. Now, having lived up there, I spent about 3 years of my life on this pipeline. That's to say, I'm pretty much like all you. I'm first world. You know, I like infrastructure. But I really like good infrastructure that's going to help people, not infrastructure that's going to make a mess of the world. So I spent 3 years of my life talking about one of the stupidest ideas I ever heard in my life, which is throw giant oil fields, snakes, that are full of poisons that are going to leak across the water. You can't do anything. We all got to drink the water. You know, so it just seemed like a crazy idea. I just want to say I spent 3 years on this. So I spent a lot of time thinking about this. And I went to a lot of these hearings. And this DOC, PUC guys, they didn't treat us good. I don't know how else to put it. They dissed all the way across. My people came to those hearings. We cried. We told stories. We told about our lives. We told about how we could barely even live and we have very little left. And that wild rice is what we have left. Those fish are what we have left. We told that, and we talked about how we were afraid. And we did it over and over and over, and it didn't seem like anybody heard it down here. In fact, we had to hold our own hearings because they wouldn't come to our territories, and they would not come to our communities. So the Mille Lacs Band and the White Earth Band held their own hearings. That's how disrespected we were by the PUC and by the DOC. And then here, it was about a month and a half ago, I went to the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. The guy from the DOC shows up over there and says, we'd like to start consulting with you. I was thinking, wow, that's about time. We said from the beginning you had to talk to us. But they said at the DOC and the PUC, no, they don't have got to talk to the native people. They don't got to talk to the tribes. They didn't have a responsibility. When we all know that that's a government responsibility. So we were treated really, really bad. That's why we don't think that these guys are capable of carrying out the task that they've got set ahead for them. You know, as my colleagues from Honor the Earth explained, you have some agencies that know how to do some environmental stuff, and you have some agencies that don't know how to do that. And these guys don't know how to do it. They don't even know how to talk to us. So that's why we all wrote letters. The tribes told you that already. White Earth Band, Mille Lacs Band, you know, 1855 Treaty Commission, Minnesota Indian Affairs Council all said, you guys cannot let those guys run these hearings because they don't even know how to talk to us. So I just want to come down here and say, that's why we think it's a really bad idea. And we live here, a super long time, like 8,000 years. We're pretty much old school OG, right? You know, and if you want to think about it, like I'm saying, like it'd be really great to get along because this is 2015. This is not 1889. And this is not 1934 when at gunpoint you burn our houses and drive us out of our territories. Still then. This is 2016, and it is a really great time to figure out how to get along. We should not have to come down here, and you should, in fact, come see us sometimes. It's really nice when you get outside the city. You think different, and you get to drink the water sometimes right from a lake. So we're super concerned about the whole process. Our people didn't go to the hearings they just had this last week and the numbers that they went to before. And why was that? My colleague Don explained that we have a lot of stress already in our communities. We have suicide epidemics in those villages that you want to put this pipeline through, or you want to let them talk about it. And we are already poor, and we are already not feeling good. And so this is not a good thing to add more duress to us. You know, it is not time to kill any more Indians in the state, frankly. It's time to really figure out how to get along and to be human beings. So that's why we didn't come to those hearings, because a lot of people, we had suicide epidemics in a couple of those. So what I want to say is that, you know, here we are as this opportunity. I wasn't really sure I was going to come down and talk to y'all, because I got kind of tired, because I felt like I said it all like 45 times, and I wanted to get out and put my corn in. I wanted to get out and, you know, get some of the fish fertilizer onto my fields. I wanted to get out and do what we need to do in this world to live. And so instead came down here, because you guys could do the right thing. You could say, we want to take responsibility, and we want to make sure the right people have these discussions. And that those discussions are held in communities where people can hear them, you know, and be there, not like the 2nd and 3rd of January and weird stuff like that. But it's too hard to already get around in the north. You know, and right now, you know why the Minnesota Chippewa tribe isn't down here? A couple of things. First of all, the letter came from you. The letter came from you 20 days before now. These guys had 20 days to respond to get down here. In the midst of tribal elections on every single Minnesota Chippewa tribe election and election appeals on every single one of those. And today, that's right, the Minnesota Chippewa tribe is in fact meeting. They have their own meetings today. And so your hearing is scheduled on the same day as their meetings. And then you're kind of wondering. So I'm saying we're way better to work together over the long haul than to waste our people's time, whether my people or your people's time, in working this stuff out. And the decisions we got here are good decisions. It's like everybody else said here, these are good people. We all said pretty much the same thing. We said the same thing as like, this is our chance to do the right thing. And so when our great-grandchildren, mine and yours, are here, and they ask, you know, or they talk about what their grandparents or their great-grandparents did when there was a chance to keep them from poisoning the water, they'll be able to say, you know, we can still drink the water because our grandparents did the right thing. That's your chance. That's your chance. Thank you. Be good.
Thank you very much, Ms. LeDuc, for those comments. I think what we'll do is take about a five-minute, maybe it'll stretch to 10 break, and then come back and pardon me? Yeah, as short as you can please make it anyway. So 2 hours sitting in one spot is enough. So we'll just
yep. Go outside.
Stand
at
recess for the next 5 minutes.
Go outside.
Yeah, it is perfect outside.
Yeah. If you could slowly find your way back to your chairs, that would be a good thing.
Developer has to we just determine. That's why you have the scoping. Here's what you guys got to look at, and then they come back.
Questions?
Wait, let me see the front of ours.
Yeah.
Boy, they bailed on us.
I'll reconvene the EQB board, and I think some of the members of the board are still milling around outside. I appreciate folks sticking around and being those that testified and being able to answer any questions. I think we're at this point in time open for discussion from members of the board. Ms. Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. I just have a few questions for various people. We could do that. And I first want to say I really appreciate the testimony of the folks who came down and who submitted written testimony. I feel like a lawyer for the first time actually having all of this and carrying it all around. And so I think clearly there's a lot of...
Are you looking for sympathy or...
No, I'm expressing appreciation of citizens being good citizens. I think there's clearly a lot of interest in getting...
The lawyer issue I was talking about.
Well, there's clearly a lot of interest in getting this right. And I think we as a board need to keep that preeminent in our mind. I think it's clear that our pipeline processes maybe could use some tweaking down the line, but that won't affect this process here. And I think for me as a citizen member, thinking about doing everything we possibly can to make sure we get this right. With the process we have and the tools that we have currently. And so I just had a few questions after reading through the packet. And first, I was surprised reading through, it was actually the March board packet, the PUC got a letter from White Earth asking for them to relinquish their status as the responsible government unit, which they denied, and then the next day we got the request from Mr. Mattson here at the EQB, I think is the right timing of it. And so I am actually not sure how the PUC communicated with the EQB when it was asked to relinquish its status and have the RG as the RGU and have the PUC make that decision and have the EQB make that decision. So I just would like more information about what communication happened between the two.
I think we have members of the PUC administrative team here today, and if you're willing and able, I welcome you to welcome to the board. Please identify yourself.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good afternoon, Tom Bailey, General Counsel for the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. So, White Earth had made a motion for the commission to relinquish its RGU status, and by law it is the RGU, and so it declined to accept the invitation. And independently, the EQB had sent a letter to the commission informing the commission that Mr. Mattson had made a similar request. Only the request was directed to the EQB to consider changing the RGU designation.
Okay, so just to clarify, there was no, the PUC didn't see, well, basically the PUC action was not to inform the EQB about this. The December 21st, 2015 request.
No, board member Knuth. The commission got the motion in December, and it didn't decide it until March. And that was, it held the motion until it made a decision in the middle of December on a number of issues in the docket. And then it asked the White Earth Band whether it wanted to, based on the decisions that had been made, whether it wanted to maintain its motion or not. It decided that it did. And so then we put it on for a decision. My recollection, and I joined the commission in March, just before the decision was made on the White Earth Band's motion. My understanding was there's no communications back and forth between the EQB and the MPUC on that particular motion by the White Earth Band. Subject to check, but I don't believe there was. What I do know is that while that was going on, Mr. Mattson made a motion. There was a subsequent motion that was supported by another gentleman whose name escapes me right now. And then, as the record points out, there was a third motion, all directed to the EQB to address the same issue.
Okay. Thank you. I was curious about that because I think one of my challenges as a board member is that the scoping process has already started, and it felt sort of like the EQB was not informed earlier when this issue was brought up, and so I was just wanted to confirm that in fact was the case in terms of the communication between the PUC and the EQB, because clearly in this whole process the relationship and the communication amongst all these agencies is what matters in terms of the right combination of expertise. And so I just wanted to establish it was something I kind of read and put a bunch of exclamation points by and was like, why didn't we know about this, right. Basically.
Well, and again, Board Member Knuth, the by statute, the commission has been identified as the RGU, and the EQB's rules point that out. So there was no attempt to hide the ball at all because, it, as a matter of fact, the commission is the RGU. And then when we got the motion, again, it's part of the public record and dealt with the motion directly with the band in relationship to a number of motions that did deal with scoping, amongst other things.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, since Mr. Bailey is in the chair, may I ask a question?
Sure. If okay. Mr. Bailey.
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Bailey, I had a really hoped today to be a lot clearer about the RGU status of this. When I read back through the petitions, there was really quite a wide variety of what people were asking for. Some were asking to remove the DOC and replace with, you know, it was just really all across the board. And then I confused myself even further by looking at the transfer of responsibilities in 2005 from the EQB to the PUC and DOC. And it seems as though functionally, many of the RGU capacities are being carried out by the Department of Commerce under your rules. Can you clarify this at all for me? Who the RGU is and how the relationship between the two agencies works, and what we might expect of that as we go forward, if we go forward in this way?
Mr. Bailey.
Thank you, Chair. Board Member Heidi Tollefson. So to give you a slightly larger picture stepping back, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission is charged to regulate public utilities, including pipelines, and the Department of Commerce appears in front of them as advocates, advising as advocates in front of the commission what the commission should do as petitions come up that are brought by public utilities. The other thing that the department is charged with is to enforce the commission's orders and to also carry out certain investigations and examinations of public utilities, businesses, and matters so that the commission can be kept fully informed. Given that background, what's happened is that when the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission is designated as the RGU. It relies on the department to prepare the environmental review documents. And this has been part of a reorganization that took place back in 2005, in which a lot of staff from this organization, the EQB, was sent over to the MPUC and the Department of Commerce to carry on the function of doing environmental review for generation siting, for transmission line routing, and for pipeline routing. So as it stands today, when the commission receives a petition for a site permit, a route permit, it then opens the docket and it proceeds down the path of considering this request, and it directs the department to prepare the environmental review documents. And then what the commission does is once it gets that, and it might be an environmental assessment, it might be an environmental impact statement, statutorily the commission is required to make a determination, is this an adequate environmental review document to inform our decision, whether it's going to be a route permit or a site permit. Once the commission decides that the document is adequate, it then moves forward to make a determination whether, based on all the evidence, which is not going to be just limited to an environmental analysis, but it's also going to take into consideration state energy policy needs, it's going to take into consideration operational requirements and other various policies, not just strictly environmental in the sense of impact on flora and fauna. It's going to take into consideration other impacts, economic impacts and the like. It's going to make a determination on that and then decide whether it's going to grant the permit, whether it's going to grant the permit with modifications, or whether it's going to deny the permit. So that might be a little bit more Board Member Heidi Tollefson, then you were, but I wanted to give you the context here that this is a long-standing relationship between these two entities, with the commission having the legal obligation to consider certain permitted activities, and it relies on the department to execute the development of the environmental record, in this instance, the environmental record that it will use to inform its decision. And this has been going on for over a decade now.
A follow-up, Chris, or did you get that?
I So who is the practical, who is the functional RGU for the environmental review process and document?
The Public Utilities Commission. Consistent with MEPA and with this body's rules, you are concerned with the entity that has the most control regulating the project. And so you look to that. That is the entity that says, yes, you can go forward and do this action. No, you can only go forward and do it with these certain conditions, or no, you can't do it at all. So
yes,
your rules
no,
are
I
actually
understand the decision making part.
Right.
So yes.
I apologize for interrupting you.
Other comments or questions for Mr. Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Bailey.
John, not for Mr. Bailey.
No. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bailey.
Thank you,
Commissioner Stein.
Mr. Chair, there's been a lot of discussion of the MOU between our agencies, and I think that we need to just hear from the team that is actively implementing the MOU and be able to ask them questions directly on behalf of the concerns that have been raised by the citizens and the testifiers. So I would ask if Mr. Grant and Ms. Beeman and Ms. Naramore could come to the table and discuss the implementation and the work under the MOU between the Department of Commerce and PCA and DNR so that the board members can directly inquire of how that process is being implemented.
John, Michelle, Barb, please. Bill.
So, Mr. Grant, if I could, and you can all introduce yourselves, but if it would be, I believe it would be helpful if you, Mr. Grant, would just describe the working relationship between the three agencies, how the work under the MOU is being conducted, the staff that are involved, and how the work plan, so to speak, is being managed.
Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. As has been...
Bill, you're going to have to...
Is it on now?
When the light is off, it's on.
Makes very little sense.
Government.
Again, Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce, Mr. Chairman and board members. So, I'm not going to remember the date exactly that the MOU was entered into. It really, from our perspective, I believe, and I think I speak for all of us, was a matter of memorializing a relationship that was already in place. In other words, we've been working with both agencies since the beginning of this effort to understand the pipeline projects that have been brought forward as proposed by Enbridge and North Dakota Pipeline Company. The MOU was an attempt to make clear what that relationship would be on a going forward basis, so there wasn't any uncertainty either amongst ourselves or the public about the relationship and the work that we would be jointly doing to address the environmental review requirements under MEPA. We have separately entered into interagency agreements with all three agencies to further flesh out the actual resources that would be dedicated to these projects. And in the case of staff at the Department of Commerce, at DNR and PCA. There are staff now dedicated to this project. The funding arrangement that's in place really does not have an upper limit in terms of what we can apply to the resource needs that there might be to complete the analysis. In each of the areas that agencies bring expertise, staff have been identified who bring that expertise to the table and have extensive work experience with the resource questions that might be there. In our case, as Mr. Bailey has noted, we've been doing environmental review work on behalf of the Public Utilities Commission on a wide variety of energy infrastructure projects, including pipelines, for the last decade or more. And so we do bring that expertise to the table. In the case of, I'll let Barb and Michelle speak for the types of expertise that they bring and the resources that have been dedicated to the project. But I want to be very clear that there's no sense in which, A, we haven't been working together all along, or B, that we have placed limitations on the type of work that can be conducted, the type of analysis that we can do. I think we have in place a very strong team, both technically and from experience in doing this kind of work, to help move this forward and bring to the Public Utilities Commission a thorough EIS, which documents all of the potential risks associated with the project, any strategies there might be to mitigate those risks, and an evaluation of the alternatives to the project that is required by MEPA. That's the process that we're in right now. That's why we have a draft scope out for review. The fact that there needed to be in that draft scope a statement of purpose was really intended to get the public's feedback on that and for purposes of then later evaluation once the PUC has approved the scope. So I'll stop and let Barb and Michelle add what they will.
Ms. Nairmore.
Well, thank you, Chairman Fredrickson. And for the record, I'm Barb Nairmore, Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I think Deputy Commissioner Grant has certainly outlined at a high level the MOU and the additional funding agreement that we have in place. I would concur with his observations about the general nature of the working relationship across the three agencies. I think we have a well-established framework for ensuring at an agency leadership as well as a staff level that we have the kinds of connections across the agencies that are going to allow us to make sure that we're bringing to that EIS development process the relevant range of agency expertise and experience with respect to both questions of science and resource management, but also the expertise that resides within each of the three agencies on environmental review process. You know, this is a very broad and interdisciplinary type of environmental review that each of our agencies has different kinds of environmental review experience doing relevant types of analysis. So again, in addition to that technical expertise, the different experience across the environmental review programs is certainly pulled in through the MOU. The one other thing I would mention, just elaborate slightly on, we do have funding agreements in place. Those are bilateral agreements. So DNR has one with Commerce, and then PCA has one with Commerce. And those specify at a kind of an estimated level that the types of staff, the amount of staff time, any other resources that are required. And precisely because we recognize that this is a complex environmental review process, and we're going to gain great insight into the through the scoping period in terms of what additional resources are going to be necessary to actually conduct the environmental review. The initial funding agreement looks at that first EIS scoping phase and then explicitly identifies that as we make the scoping determination, that then we'll come back and look at what resources are needed from each of the agencies to go on down the rest of the EIS development process. So I think we certainly have built-in flexibility into that agreement to ensure that we're identifying at each phase what resources we need and ensuring that through Commerce they have the appropriate funding agreement with the project proposer to ensure that each agency is able to bring those resources to bear.
Before we go to Michelle, Commissioner Rothman?
I'll ask after.
Okay. You yield to Michelle then.
She has the floor now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and board members. My name is Michelle Beeman. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency and part of the senior level team here that works very closely now on this project. And I would just reiterate and support what both Barb and Bill have said. Between the MOU, which fleshes out in more detail the working relationship and the topics and how we are going to move forward together, it cements what has started earlier on. But certainly in this new phase where we are doing, as everyone has used the words, the MEPA-compliant environmental review, our staff are working together. We have outlined, and I was just sort of checking back on our funding agreement, that we have at least a dozen staff within PCA alone, ranging from hydrologists and GIS and wetland certification experts, emergency response and remediation, our environmental review managers, supervisor directly involved. I mean, it's a whole range that we are bringing to bear, as is DNR, as is Commerce. And they are meeting, the staff are meeting regularly, management meeting weekly. We are having standing meetings regularly to keep making sure that we're integrated. So in terms of reassuring both the public as well as this board that it truly is a three-agency supported partnership going forward, we can speak to that very directly. No one agency has the full range of expertise, as I think you hear and understand, and we're doing our best, as Barb said, to bring our different experiences in going through environmental review and the different types we have and sharing that and sorting it out in these meetings. This is a very complex project. It will be a complex EIS, and we're doing our best to try to both be efficient but also comprehensive and bring our three agency perspectives to the table each time we meet.
Commissioner Rothman.
So what I'd just like to do is have Bill comment on, or Michelle or whomever, on some additional topics just to brief the board. In addition to the topics you mentioned, Bill, if you would talk a little bit about the spills analysis that's anticipated. Second, talk about the scoping process status, including the public hearings and how we maximize those. And then if you would update everyone on the tribal consultation process and policy implementation, including bringing on board the expertise of the Department of Transportation.
Certainly.
Mr. Grant.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for those questions. As Commissioner Rothman notes, one of the aspects of the environmental impact statement that's been a feature of the plans for the EIS from the beginning has been a very detailed analysis of spills, either major ruptures or pinhole leaks and everything in between. We've worked closely amongst the agencies that have expertise in this area as well as with our consultants to develop a data set that would allow us to analyze the impact of spills in a wide variety of ecosystem circumstances so that we could really look at what the impact would be on every type of ecosystem that the pipeline would pass through, That's not only just with the company's preferred route, but with alternatives as well, so that we have a really deep understanding about what those impacts would be if they were to occur. That analysis is going forward now, and there have been a number of representative sites identified where we have a strong data set to be able to analyze the fate of oil if it were to spill, again, in a variety of ecosystem settings. So I expect, I think that this is accurate, that this will be one of the most detailed spill analysis modeling work that's been done for an EIS for a pipeline anywhere in the country. So that's a strong part of the eventual product, the EIS product that we intend to deliver to the Public Utilities Commission. Turning to scoping, we issued a draft scope in late April. It's out for review now. As part of that process, though the rule only asked us to conduct one public meeting, we actually went out and did a dozen public meetings, various locations around the state, particularly in the project areas, but here in St. Paul as well. Those meetings were very well attended. Hundreds of Minnesotans participated, and I will say both advocates for the pipeline and opponents to the pipeline spoke in large numbers. The scoping period will conclude on May 26th, and the public has the opportunity to supplement our record during the scoping phase with written comments. We do expect to receive a number of written comments. Following that, staff from the three agencies will first digest the comments that we've received, make any modifications to the draft scope that we feel are necessary given the comments that we've received, and submit that draft scope for approval to the Public Utilities Commission. I don't have a firm date for you yet when that would occur. We're going to take the time that it needs to take in order to provide a full and thorough scoping document to the PUC. Finally, with respect to tribal consultation, and in this instance, I can only speak for Commerce. I know that the other agencies have their own consultation processes in place. We have, as Commissioner Rothman noted, developed a draft tribal consultation policy. Though we weren't one of the agencies named in the governor's executive order, given this project and other interactions we have with tribal governments on a regular basis, we felt it was necessary to take that on ourselves to develop. We've worked closely with the tribal consultant for the Department of Transportation in preparing that document. Thank you, Commissioner Zelli. It's been a tremendous help to us in crafting that document. Given the timing, though, of this project, we haven't waited for that consultation policy to be finalized before actually beginning to meet, both on a staff-to-staff basis and, in one instance so far, as a formal tribal consultation process with the tribal governments that are affected by the project. I believe that each of the tribal governments who would be directly affected by the project have now had at least a staff-to-staff discussion, in some cases several discussions, so those have been ongoing. As far as the tribal consultation policy itself, it has been reviewed by the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and their recommendation was that we take that then to formal consultation with all 11 tribal governments, and we are in the process of scheduling those meetings for this summer now. And so our hope is that by sometime later this summer, we will have in place a formal consultation process and be using that for this project and the other instances in which consultation is deemed important. So I'd be happy to elaborate further if there are any questions about any of that.
Thank you.
Questions? I'm struggling with the fact that we have folks gathered here today that are saying we're not doing what we should be doing. And so how do we get to a point where we talk about a scoping document? I assume that means what we're going to measure and what we're going to take into consideration. How do we gain the trust of people that are coming here and saying, we don't trust us? You know, what we have here is the Cool Hand Luke approach. We have a failure to communicate the good work that you're telling us you're doing. What are we missing here? How can we get that message back out that, yes, you can trust the work that we're doing? I know all of you. I trust you. Why can't we get that message out?
Well, I can take a first stab, but hoping that my colleagues will jump
back
in as
up.
Well. I want to acknowledge that we've certainly heard the concerns as well. We've sat through all of these meetings that you've had here, as well as all of the concerns that have been raised at the Public Utilities Commission and in the public meetings and hearings that we've had around the state. I would be the first to acknowledge that once trust is lost, it's difficult to regain. And our commitment is to provide the Public Utilities Commission, as they've required us to do through an order to us, the best possible environmental review document possible, and to do that in a way that allows them to make a fully informed decision. As far as the concerns around the MOU and interagency agreements that we have in place, one idea that we've had is to, in fairly short order, host an open house where we invite people to first review the documents. They're short. They're within easy reach for anyone to get through, I think, in a short amount of time, but then to answer questions about it with all of the staff there that are currently involved in doing this work, including the three of us and all of the agency staff that are now committed to the project, and to answer questions that people and concerns that people have about it. And so that would be one approach. Whether people would find that useful or not, I don't know, but we'd certainly be willing to do that.
There were some suggestions made regarding the MOU, and is it, in your opinion, would that be a tool that one could use to further develop an opportunity to instill a higher level of trust in what we plan to do as we move through this process?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. And we developed an MOU that served the purpose of identifying the relationships between our three agencies. And I think from our perspective, it is fulfilling that need. It wasn't intended as a document to address all concerns that there might be about the work that's being collectively done on this project or anything else related to it. So, within the scope of what it was intended to do, if there are concerns about it that we could address through language changes and what have you, I certainly think we'd be open to looking at that. But again, I think maybe too much has been made of it as a document for satisfying all concerns. Mm-hmm.
Kate, and then Mike.
I just have a few questions because I think for me, the public trust and the transparency is really important in this process, and so and tribal consultation is really important in this process, and so I appreciate that. Even one of my questions is commerce subject to the governor's executive order on tribal consultation. It's not, but it sounds like you're taking steps. So my question is, I have not had time to look up the governor's executive order, but is the PUC subject to the executive order on tribal consultation? No. Okay. I think that's something we as a board should be aware of, and I think concerned about, because they haven't been directed in the same way as these, well, two of these agencies and one who's working on it. I think that's a piece of information I didn't have before just now. And I think there's a few questions on transparency. One was in the DNR's letter. I don't remember. DNR, oh, here, I have a handy tab saying DNR not intervening. To the PUC, and it's regarding a petition related made by the White Earth Band. But the important part is the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, not a party in the above reference proceeding, and in light of DNR's role in assisting in the preparation of environmental review documents for this proposed project, the DNR has opted not to interview in the proceedings as a party. And so I'm in a weird way, this MOU is making me nervous about transparency in terms of what the PCA and the DNR really think or view in these proceedings, especially since they explicitly say we're not going to intervene, at least. And I don't know if that's in just this specific case or overall. And I think Mr. Diesner brought up the question, if there's a disagreement, who gets to decide? Who wins? And how does the public know how that happened? I mean, at least if you're intervening, we have a record of it. But I'm trying to understand, if the DNR and PCA are not intervening, that they're working more closely with, what happens when there's a disagreement? How is the public to understand that process of how that, well, who decides if there's a disagreement, and how is the public supposed to understand that process of who decides and how various decisions were made?
Anyone wish to take a crack at that?
Well, I can just start, but I do think you need to hear from both other agencies on that point. The Public Utilities Commission order is the one that directs the Department of Commerce to prepare the environmental review document. From our perspective, it did not make sense to relinquish that without clear direction from the commission. And their order was to the department to prepare these documents. We have felt and sought an order from the commission subsequent to that earlier order, clarifying that a MOU between our agencies to cement the cooperative arrangement that we have would make a lot of sense. The approach that we're taking to decision making in this case, even though we are the lead agency and the ones with the direct responsibility back to the commission, has been to achieve consensus on all of the decisions that we have to make regarding any of the decision points along the way. And we have not encountered a situation yet where we simply weren't able to reach an agreement amongst ourselves about how to proceed. And there have certainly been wide-ranging conversations around some of these issues, and different points of views have been expressed, but we've always managed to come to an agreement amongst ourselves about those and speak with one voice back to the commission.
Let's see. Mr. Chair, I wonder, Mr. Grant, could you tell us how the other two agencies, the DNR and PCA, participated in the draft scope that is now before us?
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Board Member Heidi Tollison, they participated in the same way that we participated in all of the efforts that we've undertaken so far under the MOU, and that is that, as I think Michelle noted earlier, we have a structure in place that brings our staff together, brings the manager units or individuals of those staffs into the conversation, and then ultimately the three of us into a decision-making role about both the draft scope and all of the other materials that have been prepared subsequent to the MOU.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I understand the structure. Was the MOU in place when you did the draft scope?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, yes, it was.
Yes. And I know there's been a lot of concern about the draft scope, and my question has to do with all of the input that you all received through the CEQ process, you know, through that process and through all the public meetings, and people continue to focus on this purpose or definition of the project. And I'm just wondering why, if you or how much has that changed from the original CEQ scope? And if so, how has it changed? And if not, given all the input you've had, and this is just an example, I'm just taking an example, why hasn't that changed? Why hadn't that changed in this second draft?
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Board Member Heidi Tollison, as we saw it, the purpose of the draft scope was really to invite public reaction to that so that we could make adjustments to the purpose statement and all the other elements that we need to review as part of putting a scope in front of the commission. We wanted didn't get as much feedback on this point as we had hoped during the public meetings. I'm hoping we'll get more of that in the written comments to really help clarify what the purpose statement ought to look like. Having said that, I don't, you know, the review of alternatives under this project won't rely strictly on the purpose statement. It's not something that's going to be determinative of which alternatives we analyze. We're looking at not just the purpose, the intended purpose for the project, but also the environmental impacts, the socioeconomic impacts, and I believe there's one more, which I'm not remembering at the moment. And those, all of those things are going to be part of what guides us as we put a full and final scope in front of the PUC.
So the alternative routes have to meet the purpose.
Excuse me. If you have some comments, I would request that you go through the process of coming up to the table and requesting a chance to speak. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say we have had some testimony to the contrary, but I didn't know what to do with that. I have, Mr. Chair, if I may, I think what, if I may expand a little bit upon what you were saying, Mr. Chair, I think what we may be thinking about is that several of the testifiers and the proposers, like in Mr. Dietman's proposal, have indicated that that the public trust that has been so well documented as being lost in this situation, it's quite a record, might benefit from the openness that you've indicated that you could have to discussing the MOU and the MOU process. And I don't know how the agencies feel about that, you know, the authoritative agencies, the commissioners. But I think that is an opportunity that perhaps the commissioners could think about how that could help, because when we were discussing what problem are we trying to solve, you know, and one of them is the public trust. One of them is this issue of the public trust. And
Commissioner Rothman,
I'll just say this. I don't know if it's a question or a comment, but just to follow up with that and the comments that staff have made. The first is that we expect, I expect a full and comprehensive, complete EIS process and all of the, all, whatever what it goes in, you know, all that goes into that. Second, to make sure that we have a commitment to an open, public, transparent process, so that and engagement, and so that we can facilitate that to the extent that we can. I agree with some of the comments. If we have an issue on trust, we will work diligently on the commitment to openness and making sure that people understand the issues and questions like you and anybody else has. We're committed to answering those questions, and I think that it is a good idea. It's been suggested to have an open house, not just on the MOU, but on any questions. I think we're happy, all of us, to do that, to facilitate any questions that people still have, even if it's not the MOU. I've also said to folks, I'm happy to entertain questions directly from other board members or anybody else that has them, and we'll get the answers from our staff and out to everybody.
Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd also like to thank everybody for coming down today and commenting. You know, what a lot of these people call coming down, I came down too. Where we're talking about, that's my home. I also catch fish up there. I also take my sons out fishing. Also collect wild rice. Don't collect it on my lake, Big Sandy. I prefer Minnewah wild rice. That's the longest grain, some of the best rice there is. So I'm familiar with this area. I drive through Warba quite a bit. Prefer Bena because there's a lot better smoked fish available at the stand at Bena. I've had it a lot. So this is my backyard. What all, I don't know how many of you guys call this up north. I call it home. It's where I live too. This pipeline goes right through the county I represent, Aiken County. Couldn't have higher stakes in the game, right through the watershed that I live in, fact. So very, very near and dear and close to my heart, and we're watching this very closely as well. As Commissioner Rothman just pointed out, you know, there are open meeting laws and transparency expectations, and we certainly expect these rules to be followed and adhered to. And I expect the agencies will all do that. I've seen nothing but integrity on the part of the agencies and the dealings I've had with them on all the committees I've dealt with Bowser over the years. There's been nothing but integrity, and I've never seen a subservient relationship with one agency to the other. If there's an issue that an agency has, they're not going to keep quiet and wait to be called on. They're going to bring that up. But when it comes to rules, we also have rules to follow this board. We talked about that during the comment period last time. We're looking specifically for input on 4410-0500 subdivision 6. Those are the rules we use to adopt a decision today to determine whether or not we move forward to the resolution or not. Those are the rules that we must follow. As we sit here and expect agencies to follow each of the rules, we also must follow those rules ourselves. If we don't follow those rules, then why would anybody trust us to follow future rules as well? It just wouldn't make any sense. So as was pointed out, we are going to be making a decision based upon 4410-0500 subdivision 6, who's got a greater level of expertise. Well, as I look at the four agencies that are involved in this MOU, you could plug one in one spot and one in another spot, you're going to get the same result. These agencies are going to approach this EIS with a great deal of integrity. They're also not going to issue an adequacy determination if they don't find it to be adequate. I'm confident of that. I've been watching a variety of EISs work their way, many of them pertinent to northern Minnesota. The Highway 53 reroute, the Red River, Polymet. There are EISs going on all the time. And if you follow all of the EISs, you will find that there's a great deal of integrity being exercised by these agencies. So back to the decision at hand today. We have to make a decision, as the chair pointed out. He wants to take a vote today, and I think you'd like to hear the vote as well. Under the rules that guide us, I find we have no other choice other than to adopt staff recommendation and approve the resolution. those recommendations, those findings, and those conclusions are based on the rules that we have to follow. We can't just go off and do our own playbook. We have to follow rules as well. So to that end, I am going to move approval of the resolution and staff recommendation of denying the RGU change status. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You've heard the motion. Is there a second?
Is there a second to the motion? I'm not seconding it, but I would like to comment.
I think we should get a...
Mr. Chair, I'll second.
Pardon me? Okay, you second it. Okay, now, the motion's made and seconded. Okay, discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I didn't think I would get emotional about this, but Mr. Mattson got me emotional in his testimony and talking about his grandkids. And for the first time, the kid thing isn't theoretical for me. It's been kicking me for the last few hours from the inside. And so I'm probably maybe a little more emotional than usual, too. And I've been really struggling with this because I am someone who believes very deeply in the integrity of public process and very deeply in the rule of law and making sure we get that right. And I'm also someone who believes very deeply that our rule of law has not worked equally well for everyone in our state. And that's very clear, I think, through some of the comments from some of the tribal representatives and lots of data the state has been discussing in the last few years. And so I also want to make sure that our decision reflects that. And I think we are coming down. We do have the narrow decision under Rule 4410.0500 subdivision, or subpart 6, not subdivision. I would say in the last week I've looked more at state statute and law than I ever did as a legislator. So I'm trying really hard to follow it.
Very comforted by that.
Instead of, when you make it, you don't have to follow it as much. And so I put the, there's a handy little search. And I've been thinking a lot about what does that idea of expertise mean? What does it mean, notwithstanding subparts 1 to 5, the EQB may designate, and we've already said within 5 days, the EQB already said we're not going to worry about 5 days. 5 days is a constraint we're not going to worry about. So may designate a different RGU for the project if the EQB determines the designee has greater expertise in analyzing the potential impacts of the project. And I would say it's very clear that no single agency has the expertise. It is abundantly clear. I think that is one of the few things we can all 100% agree on in this decision. So then my question is, who has the greater expertise at this time in this decision? In the public context and the environmental context in which we are working. And I would say that the environmental context has changed in the last decade, 20 years. Our testifiers have talked about climate change, not because it might necessarily be a narrow read of subpart 6. They've talked about climate change because you can't talk about a pipeline without talking about climate change in our current environmental context. If we do that, our environmental review process is not matching the environmental context within which it is working. It is written in a different time, and we as a board need to recognize that it's our job to apply it at this time and in the climate context in which we live. And the other thing I think is really important is expertise can be on water, and it can be on land, and it can be on air emissions, and it can be in all of these things. And I think those are really important. But as one, I can't remember which testifier said, expertise can also be on process and on engaging with the public and on tribal consultation. And the context of pipeline decisions now is very different than it was 5 or 10. It's especially different than 20 years ago in terms of the public's expectation on how we do that process. And then the third, as part of that public process, I think the tribal consultation component is with the governor's executive order and with the conversation we've had today is a different context than it was 5, 10, 20 years ago. And so I'm left with which agency has the greater expertise in the context in which we are working with this EIS. And while I would love to change some things about the environmental review process with EIS, and perhaps the legislature and then us will take that up, I'm not willing to say that needs to happen and we're going to have a narrow view of this based on what the history of expertise has been. I am interested in what the expertise, or the history of expertise on pipelines and linear infrastructure, although pipelines and transmission lines are very significantly different. So I am interested in answering this question and therefore don't support this findings and decision. And I have a lot of highlighted details I could go into about why. But I don't support it because I think the expertise that I am most interested in, that I think the context in which this review is happening, is one in which climate change is preeminent, is one in which public trust and citizen expectation of engagement is preeminent. And frankly, our citizens have gotten way better at doing this. They got the appellate court to say you're doing it wrong. Like that's a significant change in how we're doing environmental review of pipelines, and it shows significant interest and savvy and high expectation amongst our citizens. And so from my view, and I think the tribal consultation is increasingly important, but with the governor saying, with the executive order and with the testimony we've heard today, we need to be respectful that it's not in a context of, okay, well, now we're going to do it. It's in a context of very complicated, deep, painful history that I will not claim to fully understand, but I recognize is exceptionally important. And so that, Mr. Chair, is why I don't support the motion. I do have two suggestions. And in terms of, I guess, those three expertise, I see that expertise either with the PCA or with the DNR and PCA, with the PCA with their work on environmental justice and a very strong open commitment to public process. The DNR has gone through an environmental review of epic proportions in the last decade and has also experienced that. And also in terms of climate change. Climate change is a different energy question than how much do we need to use from our demand. It's how much do we need to leave in the ground if we're going to meet Minnesota's commitments under our statutes and under the 2-degree MOU that the governor has signed. So they're a different angle on those questions. But I do have two suggestions, because I don't know how this vote is going to go. One would be in terms of transparency. I would be interested as a board both of these are in terms of transparency. I think the EQB is being tested right now in terms of who we are and our role in state government. And this, I would say, is one of the two or three largest environmental review, most impactful, most important environmental reviews in terms of statewide and society-wide impact. So we as a board have to have a commitment to get this right. And so how do we use processes that we have to do that, and maybe somewhat creatively, maybe not laid out in environmental review, but I would say one is I would like to have regular updates from whatever the team is that is doing this here at the board, and in a way that the public can have more access to. I don't know if every 2 or 3 or whatever number of months we can decide that, but I think that we as a board can use this platform to create that more opportunity for transparency and accountability, frankly. Kind of accountability is very tied to transparency. And so I would make that suggestion. And I also think I would I would, if we do that, I would hope that one of the tribes or one of the integrated groups among the tribes would invite us to do one of those check-in meetings in their land. And we would be open that we've talked about going around the state, and so that would be, I think, through the next year, a really great place for us to go in the state to see really what these lands are that we're talking about and these waters that we're talking about. And then, so those two suggestions go together. The second suggestion is we as a board have a very powerful potential way to make sure that we're getting this right, and we as a board should have that. Ultimately, that responsibility of getting environmental review right is with us. And so the adequacy determination of this environmental review will be, it's a ways down the process, but there is a point once the environmental impact statement has gone out for that it's happening. I don't have the exact right word. Will maybe could help me with the, I'm missing that word at the moment. Notice of environmental impact statement preparation. Thank you. At that point, the EQB can decide to take back the adequacy determination. And instead of the preparer of the EIS determining its adequacy, the EQB can determine its adequacy. And so I that is something I'm very interested in as a citizen member, and I'm going to be pursuing. The timing of it, I'm told, is September or October, but we'll talk about that more. Because I think we as a board need to be paying a lot of attention to this. And I think that's one of the ways we can increase transparency and trust. And finally, I think that adequacy determination comes out of the scoping document. And so I'm going to be submitting comments on scoping, and I will specifically look at the purpose of the project since you were asking for that. I was not able to attend the meetings, but I will provide written comments. And I think being thoughtful and reflective and open to how we think about climate change in that scoping document is really important. Every meeting you talked about of this board subsequent to this one is about climate change. If we don't get it right in this really important process, then what does all that talk mean? So I think that's a really key part of it, and as citizens, you have until May 26 to comment on the scoping document. Please do. So I've laid out my reasons for voting no, but I also think regardless of that decision, there are things we can still do as a board that can make this process not just comprehensive or compliant or meeting the law, but I think our charge as a board is to make this process the best it can be, and we can go the extra mile or the extra several hundred miles in some cases to do that. And so I would ask, and I will continue to ask staff and work with you, Mr. Chair, to make sure that we do that well.
Thank you, Kate.
Mr. Chair, will you accept more comments? I need 2 minutes to make a couple of comments, and that's it.
Are we going to?
I'm afraid we're going to be losing commissioners here, Mr. Deesner, and I.
It's critical to what you're considering here.
Unfortunately, I also have Mr. Matheson that wants to make a comment. I'll tell you what. Can you each do it in 2 minutes? All right, and let's I'll time Mr. Deesner. So thank you,
Mr. Chair.
I'll always opt on the side of having ample public input.
Members have an additional time to comment.
My comments go to.
Oh, hold on 1 second. At this point in time, I guess
suspend the discussion of the board for additional public comment.
All right.
And then you have to get it. That's a motion someone needs to make.
We'll need a motion to suspend the discussion.
Motion to suspend the discussion of the motion.
There is a motion. Is there a second? There is a second. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Mr. Deesner,
okay,
you're on the clock.
My comments are directed at what Mr. Grant said. I just want you to think about this. He said that they've been working together for 2.5 years. Isn't that amazing that they were excluded by the DOC? As I told you before, they're working together, they got this great cooperation,
but they're excluded from the routes. And when the PUC comes in and says, damn it, what are you doing? You got to include them. What do? They exclude them. Is that really cooperation? Secondly, he said there's no upper limit on funding. That's not correct. Pursuant to the MOU, there is the authority to limit services based on limitations of funding. He may not think there's limitations right now, but the MOU allows for it. Secondly, statement of purpose. Mr. Grant has forgotten that his agency is supposed to advocate for the public. You don't advocate for the public by saying the purpose is to go to Superior. They had 2.5 years listening to the public that's where we want. We did not want it to go to Superior. It's not a correct statement. It's a bad excuse. In terms of what the biggest problem is, the DOC is in charge. As long as the DOC decides everything, you are not going to satisfy the public. You need to have other people there. The environmental report, remember, that they created said that the impacts of an oil spill are equal for water in a ditch as compared to a trout stream. And the other thing to remember about this great cooperation they have, when they produced the environmental report, the DNR, the MPCA, went to them along with other parties and said, we need more of your background information. Please give it to us. You know what this cooperation was? Sorry, it's confidential.
Thank you, Mr. Deesner. Willis, 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to respond to Mr. Neistat's comment that you're limited to that particular rule to make this decision. I would remind you that your rule 4410-0400, general responsibility, says the EQB shall monitor the effectiveness of parts 0200 through 06500, which is the whole EIS process, and shall take appropriate measures to modify and improve their effectiveness. The EQB shall assist government units and interested persons in understanding and implementing these rules. So while we appeal to you to make the RGU change under a specific rule, you are also guided by your responsibility as the EQB to ensure the effectiveness of the rule and then make changes as are necessary to ensure the effectiveness of the rule and explain them to the public. So I think you have a broader latitude within which to work. Mr. Grant said that the MOU emulates what has been going on all along and the relationship is the same. I remind you that in the packet I gave you, there must be about 25 examples where the PCA DNR differed with the Department of Commerce. Yet the ultimate resolution in every one of those cases was in favor of the DOC. That's not consensus. That's arbitrary and capricious. You suggest having an open house? If you read the public participation section of my evaluation, you would have learned that the open house is probably the single worst way to have public participation. I can give you 20 different examples of how to have meaningful public participation. That would not be one of them. I would suggest you consider actually installing some citizens. If you want transparency in the process and regular reporting, I think you could get regular updates on satisfactory participation and decision-making if you were to suggest strongly that the RGU, whoever they are, impanel several experienced citizens on the panel to continue to have input. If you can satisfy your worst critic in the process, you know you're probably getting it right. I would be willing to volunteer to be one of those critics. I have a colleague who was a career-long environmental review specialist with the DNR. could be the companion person. I would offer our services. We would hope to at least get some reimbursement for participation and time.
Thank you, Willis. I'm going to have to
solve
cut
that
you
problem.
Off.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, before a motion is taken, can we just invite staff real quickly? There are a couple typographical changes to the findings.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make a quick comment on the public record and a request of Will that he and I have discussed. Would
sure.
this be okay timing?
Sure.
I don't want to wait till after the
sure.
vote.
Sure, sure. Certainly.
Okay. I've discussed this with Will. But,
thank you.
I just want to acknowledge what an exceptional public record this is and what a huge service the citizens have done, not only in bringing the case to the court, but to the case to the commission and to the department and to the EQB. And I want to recognize, and I understand what a huge investment that has been, and that is, and will continue to be on everyone's part. I'm a little disturbed that we don't have as much acknowledgement of the public trust issues, but I know that going forward that the commission, particularly I and the department, are going to take that very seriously. And I would like to ask what we can do, and I'm addressing this to Will and to the board, what can we do to make sure that this extremely important record is not treated just as an embarrassment or a problem, but is a resource, it is, for the state and for the agencies? How can we make this record available to the commission in the PUC proceedings so that it will continue to be available to touch base on?
Sure. Ms. Ivy Tollefson will be happy to send all the comments we receive and everything else that compiles a record and share it with our colleagues at the commission.
And I'm hoping that will have standing, that will be maybe filed as having standing. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Our crack legal team has uncovered some minor typos. So,
Mr. Chair and board members, again, Courtney Allers-Nelson with EQB. I am going to identify a handful of small grammatical changes. Nothing substantive is changing. These are just very small mistakes we'd like to clear up now. The board chair has a brand new cleaned up copy, but for the rest of you, I'm going to identify the number, because most of them occur in the findings, so you can follow along. I'm referring to finding number 13. The Minnesota Environmental Policy Act is MEPA, not MEEP. We'd like to change that to MEPA. Subsequently, in finding number 19, we'd like to use that acronym and in that second line identify that for large oil pipelines, MEPA requires that an EIS be completed. So I'm striking Minnesota Environmental Policy Act and inserting MEPA. Moving on to finding number 50 in letter F, I am adding an N to A that it'll say requests for an EIS. On number 57, I am striking the S at the end of that rule quotation so that it reads question, not questions. And number 59, I am striking the word certificate of need and inserting the acronym CN. I'm also doing that for number 70 and number 71. Finally, in the conclusions of law, this is a small grammatical change. In number 4, it will now read, the EQB concludes that the proposed Sandpiper pipeline requires a full EIS in light of, so please strike the word with, in light of the September 14, 2015 opinion. Mr. Chair and board members, I apologize for the typographical errors, but they have now been corrected in your new draft.
Mr. Chair, I will consider that a friendly amendment.
You've heard the motion to incorporate the changes as a friendly amendment. Is there a second to the motion?
So moved.
There is. Is there further discussion on the motion to incorporate changes?
Only as to the friendly amendment.
Only to the friendly amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion to incorporate, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. We are on back on the motion.
Mr. Chair. I just want to make one few final comments. The first is to commit and say to the public that, yes, indeed, we do take all the comments and thoughts that have been expressed over the last two meetings very seriously. We will continue to commit to an open and public engagement process. And I think, you know, I talked about it as being a commitment to a full and complete and comprehensive EIS, but I think we, and I have, striven as much as we can to the best process that we can under the circumstances that we are given. And I do know that in all of this, at least for the agencies, we all work for the same person, the governor, and it's our goal to do the best work we can on behalf of the administration. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments?
Mr. Chair.
John?
I made a comment a long time ago in this meeting, and people might not remember it, so I just wanted to quickly do it again, and because it might inform you as to how I'm going to vote.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe that under 4410.0500 it's quite so clear as to greater expertise. I agree when you've got the commission, Commerce, DNR, PCA working together, that is the greatest expertise. But the MOU informs us as to what that working relationship is, and I don't believe it does that at this point. I would look for something more.
All right. Well, I'm going to support the motion. I think that today we've heard again from many folks that have been here or involved themselves in this discussion over the past several months. I think the discussion we've had today has been highly instructive. I hope and I know that my colleagues that are working seriously on the EIS have heard you. The Environmental Quality Board obviously has heard you. You've heard from all of the members. I think that as we move forward, we'll move forward with a clear vision of what we would like to see as an outcome. So at this point in time, I would call on Will to call the roll.
Chair Fredrickson votes aye.
Can you clarify the resolution?
Yeah.
So what an aye vote means and what a... Do you want to put up what an aye vote means and what a negative vote means?
Sure. To clarify, you're voting to approve the resolution, the findings, the conclusion, and that will go up on the screen in one moment. So an aye vote would essentially deny the petition by approving the findings.
To change the RGU.
Correct, to change the RGU. Are there any questions about what you're voting on? Okay, I'm going to go through the roll here. Chairman Fredrickson votes aye. Ms. Ide-Tolleson?
Nay.
Ms. Gehring?
Nay.
Commissioner Hardy?
Aye.
Ms. Knuth?
No.
Commissioner Lamware?
Aye.
Commissioner Mossman?
Aye.
Mr. Moybe?
Aye.
Commissioner Napstad?
Aye.
Commissioner Rothman?
Aye.
Mr. Saxog?
No.
Commissioner Stein?
Aye.
And Commissioner Zelli, I'm sorry. It's been a long afternoon.
Aye. Okay. I was waiting. I was patient.
Nine to four.
Yeah. There being nine votes in the affirmative and four voting nay, the resolution is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Commissioner of Health is not here, and Deputy Commissioner Allwood did not vote.
He can't vote. Yeah,
for the record. He is aware. Yep. Thank you. And for the record, At this point in time, we are, I believe, at the point where we're adjourning. Jason Smith has flown in from Rock Island. Jason is part of the Army Corps of Engineers to participate in this discussion today, and unfortunately we're going to have to put it off until another time, but just look at all the frequent flyer miles you're gathering up from here to Rock Island.
Yeah.
Thank you, and my humble apologies for the delay. Is there a motion to adjourn?
I'll move.
There is. Is there a second? There is. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion carries. We are adjourned.